Support for Boston Public Radio comes from North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Today on Boston Public Radio, Governor Baker has introduced a bill to ban handheld phones while driving. We'll open the lines and ask, are you ready to go hands-free? Then one of the stories highlighting the financial toll of the government shutdown is the story of how, in order to cut costs, a federal worker is cutting down on her insulin because she can't afford her copay. But this isn't just a story about the border wall budget battle. It's a story about how the cost of insulin has doubled over the last few years. We'll talk to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about this and other medical headlines.
Elizabeth Warren is refining her populist message and testing her presidential pitch on the residents of Puerto Rico. Adam Riley joins us from San Juan, where he's been tracking her latest campaign stop. Then Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen is here to talk about their latest cookbook, Tasting Italy. Finally, Cy Montgomery for another edition of Afternoon Zoo. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, it's Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. So Governor Baker has decided to crack down on distracted driving. As part of a sweeping set of road safety rules, he is calling for Massachusetts to join 16 other states, and virtually all of New England, by the way, in requiring hands-free cell phone use while driving. It's the first time he's put forward his own hands-free driving bill since he first came out in support of the idea in late 2017. We're opening the lines and ask you, is it not about time that this state gets with it? At 877-301-8970, are you ready for this to be the law? If you object to the ban, why? If you're driving right now, are you going to be calling us hands-free? Are you texting while driving? Which, by the way, if you read the famous Virginia Tech study from a few years ago, is just as dangerous as driving drunk. Our number is 877-301-8970. I have to say, I wish we had brought this up yesterday with Senate President Spilka. Of all of the bills that it seems to me this legislature should have done in 90 seconds, and the Senate passed it in two successive years, the House held it up, the former legislator, Byron Rushing, who was defeated in his primary, was concerned about racial profiling. I think it's not an illegitimate issue. All he wanted was data to be collected on racial profiling to see if that this gave an excuse for police to do it. And how simple could it be in light of the fact that it is obvious it saves lives? The reason this matters so much for those who don't know or who are undecided or ambivalent about this issue, we have a texting, a no texting while driving law. We were also one of the last in the country to do this. It is totally unenforceable. And one of the reasons there's so few citations every year is because the law allows you to do other things on your phone. So if a police officer sees you doing what he or she thinks is texting, there's no point in stopping you because you may be making a phone call. You may be searching the web.
Correct.
You may be, all of which is distracted and all of which, sadly, is legal. And if the governor's proposal, and by the way, he used to be against this till I think I said 2017. If the governor's proposal becomes law, we go a long way towards ending or at least curbing distracted driving. So I have to say, there is no downside to this. Include the racial profiling, data collection mandate, and let's pass this damn thing immediately. You don't disagree with this, do you?
Well, I must admit, now that I've traded in my ancient car, you still have yours.
I do.
And gotten a new one, updated car, and I have one of those.
Oh, Bluetooth things?
You just put the phone.
Car and a jockey
picks
up into
the
it.
Phone.
Yeah.
I haven't quite figured out how to use it completely. But anyway, I noticed that all of a sudden.
I noticed that I could do it.
The car is talking to me. I'm down with it, Jim. I'm down with it. I don't have to worry anymore about having a Bluetooth in my ear or something like that. It's obviously a good idea.
We're the 10th most, according to some Globe reporting, we're the 10th most distracted driving state. 80%, 79%, the most recent poll I saw in 2018, 79% of the people, a mere 79%, support this thing. You know, last year, you know this woman, I interviewed the Levitans, Anna and her husband, and they've been crusaders on this issue. I think the group is called Text Less, Live More. I think that's part of the organization they helped put together. Their daughter, Merritt was her name, had just graduated from Milton, was about to start college, I think at Colgate. I hope I'm right about that. Her sister, by the way, is going to be on the show with me tonight on Greater Boston. And she's on a cycling trip through the South, starting in South Carolina. A number of days in, she's in Arkansas, a distracted driver, a young man, I think he was texting, if I remember correctly, and it was legal in that state, killed her. I think she was 18 years old.
Oh, it's horrible. They're horrible.
It is. This will reduce deaths. And I have to say, even if it turns out, I mean, I know the police were upset when this bill was pending. Some police chiefs were upset because the implication was if you need us to collect racial profiling data, you must think we're racial profiling. No, they want the data collected. And if it turns out that you're not racially profiling, then it'll reinforce the notion that you're doing your jobs as well as you contend that you are. But the fact that that allowed this legislature to not do what 80% of the people here, I don't know what the other 20% are thinking, knows is the right thing to do, is it's insane.
No, you know, this seems like a no-brainer. I said before the show that I was going to go to the Globe story and look at the commenters because it's kind of the Wild West out there in the comment
section. I know
that's
true.
But there was almost nobody who was opposed to this. I mean, everybody's like, about time. This will make a big difference. We're sick of these people on their cell phones all the time, blah, blah, blah. And you're right. You see people texting on their cell phones all the time. If you're stopped at a stoplight or, you know, you're in traffic. And I think this will definitely cut down on that, too, because you're not supposed to touch an electronic device under this bill for any purpose other than a single tap or to activate or initiate the hands-free mode. So it makes it a lot easier to pull people over.
And people get used to it. People get used to it, and it gives the police more power in situations where they need it to stop people. And by the way, I admitted this to the Levitans. I was just watching my interview with them last summer. I mean, remember Deval Patrick on the show outed me 1 month?
Texting.
And after I said I wasn't texting anymore, and he says, well, I left the station last time, Jim, and I saw you texting.
Oh, my God. How many people have you rear-ended, Jim?
Well,
quite a few over the years.
But it is really dangerous, and I'm embarrassed.
On the Southeast Expressway.
I wasn't texting in either of those cases, but I did rear-end a couple of people.
Well, you weren't looking.
I was distracted. It's true. And it's dangerous. It's disgraceful. And I've stopped. And for those who haven't stopped, then this will give the power to the police to stop you before you kill somebody. 877-301-8970. And by the way, if somebody's against this, my assumption is we're going to be preaching to the choir here. If somebody's against this, you'll tell one of our coworkers who answers the phone, we'll put you up to the top of the list because I really can't think of any credible argument anymore as to why the legislature should not move rapidly on this. And hopefully, by the way, the police associations and the chiefs are very fond of the governor. And my hope is not just his support, which has existed for almost 2 years, but the fact that he's filing his own bill on this, I hope is going to make this much more likely to happen. Let's take some calls.
Let's go to Paul in Winchington. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Good, thank you.
I'm a truck driver, and, you know, if we get caught driving with our, you know, holding a cell phone, it's a $12,000 fine to the company.
Wow.
$12,000? So whoa. State law says it's a $12,000 fine?
Yeah. To the company, and then, like, a couple thousand dollars to the driver.
Wow, so you must see a lot of people texting while driving when you're up there higher than they are in your truck bed, Paul, huh?
Yeah, all the time we see them. It's like you can see them. They're not paying attention. They're driving all over the road, not, you know, slowing down, stopping. I was at a red light the other day, and there was 8 cars went by. 5 of them were making a corner, staring at their cell phones. It's just stupid to keep doing what they're doing.
Paul, I bet you see a lot of other things from your cab up high there, too, but that's for another show. You know, Paul, this huge multi-$1,000 fine, I'm betting that's an internal company thing. I don't know of a state law that imposes that level.
Is yours a national company or a local company?
Can people in the control room check this for us? I'm not questioning Paul, but I'm not aware of whatever the law is that Paul's talking about. But I'm glad you support it because obviously.
Paul, are you a national company or a local company?
Yes, I'm a national
company. So maybe
that's what we're told.
Yeah.
You know, if you get caught, it's a $12,000 fine. You know, they can, most of the time they're not going to give you a $12,000 fine, but they can if they want to. I mean, if you have an accident, you know, I mean, it's always the truck driver's fault, even though somebody's texting in front of you.
Well, you can also do a lot more damage, obviously, as you know, Paul, driving a big truck than somebody in a car can, even though somebody in a car can cause damage, too. Paul, thanks for your call, and I'm glad you're supporting this thing. 877-301-8970. By the way, what Paul said, and he has much better vantage point, obviously, from the cab in a truck. Almost every night I hit the red light right out here on Market Street on my way home from work. There is almost never a night where I look to the left and right. I do this consciously, maybe like Paul does. Every single person, not 50%, not 70%, every single person is texting. Now, you may say it's a red light, which, by the way, is still illegal in violation of law. But if you're texting when the light is red, you're probably still going to be texting when the light turns green seconds later, at least for a few seconds. So it is an epidemic, I should say. And I think this will help stop it. And if you don't stop on your own, then your local police officer will stop you on their own. By the way, our first three calls are all Pauls. What do you think of that, by the way?
Our first six emailers are all
Pauls?
We have a couple of Pauls.
Okay.
But it's finally about time. We should do this. Paul wants to get rid of putting on makeup while driving as well.
Well, you know, this gets...
I've done that, I must admit.
If you don't mind my beating the same... Well, there are a lot of distracted driving things that people do. Beating the same drum over and over again. This is what drives me nuts about legislatures, not just this legislature. In light of the fact this is something virtually everybody in the state supports, and it's not a cosmetic thing, it's a life-saving kind of thing, then if you have an issue that Byron Rushing, the former state rep, or others who care about it, Jeff Sanchez supported this too, former Ways and Means Chair, also lost his primary, then the answer is you sit down in a room for 2 hours and you resolve your differences and you pass the law and you have pass the bill and you have Charlie Baker sign the damn thing. I mean, get it done. Paul in Worcester, you're next. Oops, no, you're not. We're going to get to Worcester in a minute. Paul in Malden, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Good morning. Great show. First time caller, Maj and Jim.
Hi. Thank you for calling.
The state house, the legislature, has the Senate has passed this.
Twice.
Several times.
Yep.
It's the state house. And they have, if they're going to do this, they better just get on the ball and go with Paul. Enforce this issue of making the state legislature do it. I mean, we've got five other states surrounded by it. Everybody's out there using the phone, and you should have Bob DeLeo on there and get on him. But there's one part of the law that the governor has proposed that might be a stickler of problem.
What's
which
that?
Is making the seatbelt a primary rather than a secondary.
But for those who don't know what that means, is under current law, and Paul, you really know your stuff, under current law, you can only be stopped or ticketed or cited for a failure to wear your seatbelt if you're stopped for something else, meaning secondary enforcement. And one of the things that's in this comprehensive distracted driving bill that the governor has filed would, as Paul from Malden has said, make failure to wear your seatbelt a primary enforcement issue, which upset. I mean, the person, for those of you who are of a certain age, this is one of the issues that made Jerry Williams, who really almost started talk radio in this city, in this country, famous, campaigning against it on the ballot and legislature. But I'm with you, Paul. But I am for that, too. Thanks for your first call, Paul. Call us again soon. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You don't get worked into a frenzy about these kinds of things like I do. When
you do.
Things are really no-brainers, I don't mean no-brainers because I like it and other people don't. There is no credible argument against this.
Well, let's take Edward. Because
he's
against,
on the other
he's
side?
Against
oh,
it.
Fabulous. I'm sorry. I didn't
Hi,
see
Edward.
Edward from
we
Milton.
We want somebody on the other side. What's your argument, Edward?
Hi.
Well, I'll tell you, back in 1982, I was driving into the summer tunnel, and I was wearing a Sony Walkman headphones. And a police officer standing in front of the toll booth pointed at me, pulled me over, gave me a ticket for driving impaired. I tried to fight it because it sounded like I was drunk, but I couldn't because it was against the law to have an impairment. The police have the authority to see somebody putting on their makeup or looking at their coffee cup or looking at their phone already. We don't need another law.
No, well, actually, we do, Edward. First of all, you were impaired. I mean, the fact you were impaired because you couldn't hear. And if you can't hear a horn or something else, I think the cop did the right thing. And existing law is not good enough because the issue is not are you impaired or are you recklessly driving at that moment. Maybe you're not. But if you're on your phone, you are distracted, and maybe a minute later when the cop's not watching you, you are going to do something dangerous. So they don't have enough power without this, which is why I think, with all due respect, Edward, which is why I think that Charlie Baker, who's not a big government kind of guy, is championing the cause. So thank you for your call, and I'm sorry you're upset about your ticket from the 80s, but
remember Sony,
I would have given you a ticket too.
Remember Sony Walkmans?
Did of course.
One of those were fun.
I did, as a matter of fact.
The old days.
Paul, but by the way, you know, that really, I mean, I don't mean to attack Edward at all, but when I say it's bad enough that people are talking on their phones, some people talk on their phones with earbuds or listening for some reason in a car that has a radio with earbuds. If your earbuds are high quality, it means they're noise canceling in terms of outside noise. You can't hear what's going on.
Can you listen with one earbud?
Well, why do you need an earbud?
Well, I don't know.
Turn on your radio. Plug
no,
your...
no, no. People are talking on their phones with their earbuds.
Well, then, what's that?
They're talking on their phones with their earbuds.
But they don't need to talk on their phone with their earbuds. They have either a Bluetooth or they'll use a speaker. I mean, under this new law, they're not going to be able to do that, and they don't need to do that. So, should we do our 14th poll in a row? This one's in Worcester.
I know. We have a lot of polls today.
Hello,
Paul from Worcester.
Hey, Paul.
Hello, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm hoping that our well-rested legislators will finally understand something my kids started hearing and understanding pretty much at birth. Safety is not negotiable.
That's a good line.
That's a good one. I should have thought of that when my kids were teenagers.
So, Paul, should I assume, based on your initial comment, that you're as obsessed with this five-month hiatus as I am, or no?
At least as much. And not only that, but it's 2.5 months a year, even if they did it once a year, which is who gets 2.5 months vacation a year?
Oh, don't ask Marjorie that question because we're getting a big fight. There's one other
There's one other profession, Paul.
Hey,
that
Paul,
does.
Thanks. Safety does. It's non-negotiable. That's a great line, and it's totally true. Paul, thank you.
But we had Senate President Karen Spilker on yesterday, and she defended the five-month vacation.
She did. I mean, I disagree with her. She didn't shy away from it. And by the way, she didn't dance around the question. She basically does defend it. And I think she's wrong.
She says legislators are in and out of the State House doing their business. This is not an official kind of thing.
Well, you know, what I didn't say yesterday, because I didn't have the data.
You know what? We should have followed up and asked her. Do they get their per diem driving in from Northampton when it's not an official business? You know, State House legislators.
Well, there's another issue. They're in formal sessions very rarely. And the notion that you can't campaign for reelection and do your job is preposterous. I find her to be a real straight arrow, by the way. My attitude about public officials, they don't have to agree with you. They at least have to make themselves available to answer questions, and they got to be honest with you. And I think she's an honest person.
You know, when I used to work for the wisecracking little Boston Herald, a couple of times a year we'd have stories about State House legislators that seemed to be padding the record in terms of their per diems.
Per diem thing?
I mean, they were driving in from East Overshoe on Christmas and New Year's and Thanksgiving and collecting all their money. I'm exaggerating a little bit. I don't know if it was actually Christmas, but there was a lot of suspicious driving in.
Exaggeration is fine.
And I think where do they park? Don't they have special parking
places? Most of them
have.
It's under One Ashburton, I think.
Under
a lot
One
of them
Ashburton.
Do. They do.
Okay.
But by the way, I'm not. You know, the reality is, if you do the job and you do it as a full time job, there's a whole debate about whether it should be a full time job to begin with. You know, you should get decent compensation.
We're talking about Governor Baker's proposal to ban handheld cell phone use. The consensus seems to be it's about time. We're going to keep taking your calls and emails on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Ginn. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Governor Baker's push to make hands-free cell phone use while driving the law. We're taking your calls, asking you if it's about time. Do you worry this will give police another excuse to pull people over, whether it's based upon your concern about racial profiling, as former state rep Byron Rushing did, or that caller a few minutes ago who said he was pulled over being impaired, which I think he was. Impaired doesn't just mean drunk. Impaired if you have earbuds in and you can't, or whatever earbuds were called whenever he was stopped in the 80s. you are impaired. I mean, that is what it is. 877-301-8970. And because virtually everybody buys this, if people disagree like that caller did a minute ago, you tell one of our coworkers when he or she answers the phone, and we'll pop you up to the top of the list.
Okay, let's go to Rama in Gloucester. Hi, how are you?
Hey there.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. How y'all doing today?
Great. Good to Thanks talk for to you. Calling.
Great. Yeah, and Jim, yes, the five-month hiatus is corrupt. It's just pure political corruption, and Karen Spilker is a politician, and their politicians want to stay in power. They will keep that five-month hiatus, but we digress.
We do. Or you do.
Yes. So,
go ahead.
So, yeah. The thing about that law is it doesn't matter unless, number one, the police, state and city police, enforce it and choose to, because they're on their cell phones, too, busy on their cell phones, especially at details. You watch them. They're just looking at their cell phones when they're supposed to be doing their jobs. I know Marjorie.
I don't know if that's fair, by the way, but go ahead. I think they want to enforce this from the cops and the chiefs and commissioners with whom I've spoken. They just have a really hard time because, as I said before, they can't enforce an anti-texting law because they don't know if you're texting or not.
Okay, but can I make one other
sure,
point?
Sure, of course.
Unless we make the penalty severe enough, it won't change. What I propose is make it the same as a DUI because it is driving under the influence. It is impaired like Edward. That is impaired. Driving under the influence is anything that's going to make it dangerous for us to drive. And we're on our cell phones, all of us. All of us are on it. We look around, everyone's on it. And unless, if there's a DUI, I'm gonna bury my cell phone in the back seat. But unless, and I don't text, but occasionally I do dial and I call people on the text on the phone. And it's like, I shouldn't even be doing that. So if I know it's a DUI, I'm going to throw that phone away until I get out of the car.
Can I tell you something? I hadn't looked at the fine level in the Globe story until you mentioned $100 is not enough for the first offense. Because the average person is going to make a calculation. If they're dying to use their phone with their hand, is they're going to say, well, I'm probably not going to get caught for the first 100 times I do it. So $100 fine, I'd prefer not to pay it, but it's not the worst thing in the world. Second fine, by the way, second offense, $250, all subsequent offenses, $500. I agree with you. The legislature is not going to up it, but I think your point is a wonderful one, and I wish they would. Thanks for your call, as always. 877-301-8970. Yeah, the reason I think I am so obsessed with this is because I understand the legislative process because I used to be a lobbyist, and I use the term very loosely, but they really could fly this thing. Just like when we asked yesterday, when we asked Karen Spilka, when we're talking about amending the state unemployment law so federal furloughed or forced workers could collect unemployment at some point. I said, can you do it quickly? The answer was yes. Whatever they want to do quickly, they can do quickly. And this is something that is a life-saving. I asked the Levitans if their kid would be alive, if Merritt, their daughter, would be alive, had a law like this existed in Arkansas. And they said probably yes. And I think they are right. It saves lives.
You know, we have two emails with some good questions. John wants to know about why punish people with older cars. But I think no matter that you're punishing people with older cars that don't have the hookup with the radio that the new cars do.
Get a Bluetooth.
But you can just get a Bluetooth. Exactly. That's what I thought.
And by the way, Baker, my understanding is one of the reasons why he opposed this early on until he switched his position was because it imposed a significant cost.
Right.
This stuff is really cheap. I mean, high-end Bluetooth is not that cheap. A crappy Bluetooth that's decent enough to use is not that expensive as a life-saving kind of thing.
But can't you just raise something? What's and that? I think we have talked about this before.
What is it?
That there are a lot of studies that say talking on a cell phone is not necessarily more dangerous than a lot of other things you do in distracted driving.
No, it's not just that. I raised this with Levitans, by the way. The study that I think – what's that person's name?
Candy.
What I think she's referring to, and my apologies if I'm wrong, Candy – is that it is the talking.
It's the talking.
Whether you're talking
hands-free
or not. So I guess my answer, and I've seen that research too, I think the answer to that is get rid of hands-free, and if the data suggests that that doesn't take it far enough, then the next step is the legislature should have the courage to ban talking on your phone unless you pull to the side of the road.
That's never going to happen.
Well, people thought this wasn't going to happen either. You know, we were like the 30-some state in the country to ban texting. Why is it that 30-some other states were enlightened enough to ban this dangerous behavior, and we were one of the outliers.
We're the only state in America that doesn't allow public records from the governor and the entire legislature,
yeah,
and we've indicted three speakers in a row. I mean, it's bizarre.
Not the current one.
Not the current one. But it is bizarre that with that level of corruption that we don't want a little sunshine of what's going on up there, right?
I agree with you.
Especially with the 5 weeks vacation, which you obsess
5
over.
Months.
5 months, excuse me.
It's not vacation. It is vacation.
Diane in Fairhaven. What do you think, Diane?
Hello, Diane.
Hi. Yes, when I taught my son how to drive a couple years back, like the previous caller had said about safety is not negotiable. Anyway, so he had to first lock his phone in the glove compartment, put on his seatbelt before he would even put his, before he started the engine. So that's what
I mean because of you, by the way. You mean because of you?
Because of me what?
You mean you forced him to do that? Is that your point?
Yeah, as I was teaching him
Good.
How to drive.
By the way,
yeah.
You know the law. Now, we should have made this clear. You know the law says if you're under 18, you can't under existing law, not the proposal, you can't use the cell phone at all. Okay, go ahead.
Right. So anyway, so of course, like any 19-year-old or whatever, 18, he blew me off. But in my small town, he almost ran into a car in a parking lot. And that man who knows of him, but Nathaniel, my son didn't know him. I just gave it away. Anyway, just read him the riot act and said, "You're lucky I don't go down to the police station right now and report you." Well, that scared the life out of him.
Good.
So, at least he was honest enough to come home and tell me about it. But, you know, I'm not opposed to adults other than my husband and I, you know, calling them out on stuff if they see something that is unsafe.
Good. And when you're not there, in loco parentis, as they say, can be the local police if they're given this power that they should, at least in my estimation, and I'm guessing, Diane, in yours, they should have. Diane, thanks for the call.
You know, Anthony raises a great point, too, and he's right about this. Now that I have a newer car, how the ones, at least 2017, 16s, 18s, have these dashboard screens that are virtually laptop computers. They're pretty damn distracting, too, aren't they?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is really distracting. And by the way, the talking thing, the thing that Candy raised, the contention is that it's not just talking on the phone, whether it's hands-free or not, talking to somebody in the back seat of your car when your natural inclination is to half turn your head when you're having that conversation. That's dangerous too, but there's certain things that we can do. There's certain things that have overwhelming support, like this hands-free thing, and they should just do it quickly and get it over with.
Jack, who keeps the list of all the bans that you want to impose on the citizenry.
By the way, don't go through the list like toboggans and people should have to wear helmets as they walk down the street. I mean, there are a few things that maybe I crossed the line on. They should ban toboggans.
Since we know that it's not just the cell phones, it's the talking in the car that is a problem.
What's
this
thing?
Do you want to ban talking in cars?
Well, I would consider what I think you should do is, what's his name, Jack, who keeps the list?
Yes.
If it turns
Thank
out...
Thank you, Jack.
If it turns out, this is, Jack, write this down. If it turns out you feel you have to talk to somebody in the car, what you should do is pull over, get out of the car, stand on the sidewalk, have your conversation, then get back in. I mean, it's not that complicated. We have time for only one more quick one.
Joan in Providence. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi.
I
wanted to mention that, you know, not only will it save lives, which is the most imperative, of course, you know, possible outcome.
I'd say so, yeah.
Yes, but maybe our insurance rates would go down. There'd be less accidents. There'd be, I mean,
good
you know,
point.
Fixed income, and I'd love to see stop paying $1,000 a year for car insurance.
Wouldn't that be great?
On a 2008 Hyundai, you know, so it would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And the other, I have two other things. I live in Rhode Island, obviously, Providence, and I see it all the time. People are on the phone, people are texting, kids, mostly kids, not adults. And I think it should be, you know, supervised. I mean, yes, it's against the law here, but I see it very, very frequently.
Well, they got to crack down. I mean, this gets back, Joan, to what the caller said a minute ago, Rama, who felt that the fines in Massachusetts were not high enough. I don't know what the fines are in Providence, and thank you for your call, by the way. But they've got to be high enough that people don't do something, even if the only reason they don't do it is because they're worried about the cost of having gotten caught. Thanks so much for your calls. And by the way, if you care about this beyond calling us, and apparently all of you do, with I guess one exception so far, call your state legislator, particularly your House member, because the Senate has passed this twice, I assume they'll pass it again, and say you want them to act on this governor's proposal and you want it to be acted upon quickly.
Okay, coming up.
And by the way, the sister of the young woman who was killed by a distracted driver in Arkansas will be joining me tonight on Greater Boston at 7 o'clock. I hope you join me.
Coming up, our medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us with what could prove tragic news, really, for the undisputed MRI king of Boston, of Massachusetts, perhaps of the entire United States of America. That, of course, would be Jim Browdy. Art Kaplan tells us what's in store for Jim next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. One of the stories that's underscoring the huge consequences of this disgraceful government shutdown is the story of Mallory Lorge. She's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee who's not received a paycheck, as you know, since December 22nd, about not to receive her second one on Friday. And that means in order to cut expenses, she's also cutting down on her insulin, which she uses to manage her type 1 diabetes.
Last weekend, I didn't wear my insulin pump at all. I just took it off because I was so frightened about what little insulin I did have left, and we couldn't afford the $300 copay to buy anymore. That was my choice that day, and nobody knew. My family didn't know. My husband didn't even know that I was rationing. It's sick, but like the thought of having more debt was scarier than the thought of maybe dying in my sleep.
That is heartbreaking. But this isn't just about the government shutdown. It's about the rising cost of insulin. A new report finds the cost for insulin to treat type 1 diabetes has nearly doubled since 2012. Joining us to talk about this and other medical headlines, Art Kaplan. Art is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mini Chair and the Director of Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the excellent Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art Kaplan.
Hello.
And
hey,
hello.
Art Kaplan. Well, let's get to this insulin situation. We have a story by our colleague Marilyn Shearer about, you know, a woman before, not having to do with the government shutdown, in Jamaica Plain, who was already choosing between medication and paying her bills, and she needed insulin. It's crazy.
So here's the question about this. We have ridiculous price inflation on insulin, which we've talked about, Marjorie. You know, insulin's been around since, I think, 1923. There's no new insulin. There's not much has changed, except the price has gone up a gazillion-fold, and it's clearly monopolistic, if you will. Martin Shkreli, we know that name?
Oh,
yes,
we do.
Why don't we know the name of Novo Nordisk president and Lilly and the other couple of companies that make insulin? The insulin price story is 50 times bigger as a scandal than Martin Shkreli, who was a sideshow operating with a drug that almost nobody used, but he mouthed off a lot and he became sort of a media celebrity. All around America, diabetics are getting charged more than they can afford for insulin, and then when they lose their jobs or get suspended or furloughed, as is the case with the government employees, things get even worse. But people are rationing or changing their insulin all over the country anyway, every day. It is a gigantic scandal. Congressional hearing? State hearing? Anybody?
So why is this? I mean, we know Shkreli in many ways screwed himself by being as high profile and being as offensive as he was, not only in his drug pricing behavior, but in his human relationship behavior. What are these people who run these companies just laying low? Is that why it's?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. They're not speaking out. They're not saying ridiculously stupid things like, you know, I can charge what I want. I bought it, blah, 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 blah. They may do it, but they don't say it. And I think, and you can send me all the email, but I think the media ought to be more active on this. Not us. We're obviously yakking about it. But I think they find diabetes boring. It's just not an interesting disease. A lot of people have it, been around a long time. There may be even a little bit of a blame the victim thing going on in terms of, you know, well, why do you need these medicines? But all of that said, it's inexcusable. It's the moral scandal of 2019 so far.
So
the high
so,
price of insulin and people going off it.
So if the whoever you just mentioned, whose name we don't know, who runs one of the companies that makes if he or she was on the show and we said, defend your price hikes, what argument would they make and how much merit does it have?
Well, I think they say things like manufacturing costs have gone up, inflation has gone up, but I don't see much merit to any of it. Nothing really big has changed in the manufacture or cost of delivering insulin. So I'm completely unmoved here. I think we ought to get Shkreli-like excoriations of the companies making insulin and these gigantic price hikes, because I think they're price gouging due to monopoly, just like Shkreli did, except he did it on a tiny scale and impacted almost nobody except himself.
Didn't we have a huge uproar over the price gouging involving EpiPens?
Yeah.
So
Senator Joe Manchin's daughter runs the company.
But it, since insulin does affect so many people, I guess even with the pharmaceutical lobbyists in D.C., you would think this would be a no-brainer for congressional intervention.
Well, you know, EpiPen, I'll tell you what the moral difference is, I think, Marjorie. EpiPens, you get stung by a bee or whatever your allergic thing is, and you're going to be having a terrible reaction and might die immediately. So that commands attention.
Yeah.
Diabetes, even if you don't get your insulin, it's a slow death. It may be a miserable death, but it isn't immediate. It doesn't have that bam impact. So I suspect that's what's the difference.
Okay. Speaking of the high cost of medical care, one of the great outrages, as far as I'm concerned, is this report suggesting there's overuse of MRIs in America. Now, excuse me.
Tell him how many you've had.
Well,
200?
It is true. I was inducted into the MRI Hall of Fame on the first ballot. And just like Mariano Rivera, I got in unanimously, I should say. These numbers, I am an overuser. I know I am. These numbers cannot be real. 118 out of one. Let me just get the numbers. 118 out of 1,000 Americans have had an MRI in the last year. 245 out of 1,000 have had a CAT scan. Does that sound right to you?
No, it's way too much use. And by the way, how can you be an overuser in the sense in which you shouldn't be controlling whether you get one of these or not? The doctor should be. I mean, you could show up and say, I want my head scanned, or I fell down and I think you should scan my head. But the doctor should be saying, well, you know, unless you got some symptoms or unless there's some other reason, let's take a little wait period here and see if anything develops. Otherwise, the chances are pretty good that you don't need a CAT scan or an MRI. And by the way, you use those for very different things. But putting that aside, there's too much indulgence of the worried patient. We have to name names here.
Excuse me, Marjorie. Go ahead. Let's listen to Art. Go ahead.
And then B, there's legal concerns on the part of doctors running these tests. They're just afraid, uh-oh, something happened and I didn't do this scan. Then they're going to sue me for not doing the scan. So the safest thing to do is to do the scan, even if I don't think it's really needed. That's part of our stupid malpractice system, which, again, doesn't say, here's the guidelines, this is when you do it, and that's your defense if you're a doctor for not doing it. It just says, you missed something, 1 in 1,000 chances, you're going to be tied up in a malpractice lawsuit, so better to do it. Not my problem.
By the way, I you know, my doctor, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, I'm sure is going to be offended that you are.
I know who that is.
This raises a very important question for those who suffer from this addiction, like Jim Browdy. Can they be weaned off their attachment to medical imaging?
Well, remember, CAT scans, you know, there's some x-ray danger there. I don't think you get it with MRIs, a different kind of diagnostic thing. But you don't want to get exposed all the time to a lot of unnecessary radiation, if you will. And then the other thing is, no, they can't be weaned, and they're always going to run around saying, I think my head is broke, please take a picture, whatever. But the doctor has to be firmer and tougher and say, here's where it's indicated, these are the guidelines, that's what we're going to follow. We're not just going to indulge you because you're having a freak out here that you want your head scanned again. By the way, I'm presuming that what many of these tests would reveal is that Jim is stuffed with kumquats, which lets me mention. Are you aware that this is the opening of kumquat season?
And you mean, did I buy two boxes yesterday at Whole Foods? Is that your question? The answer is yes.
Yes.
I did.
And are you going to be attending the opening day of Kumquat Festival in Dade City, Florida on Friday?
Is there really? Is that really true?
Yeah.
If I could, I would. If people have never had a kumquat, they're very unusual, but they are really terrific. You know, one last quick thing here. I assume the reason these are overprescribed, and I do plead guilt. I'm not the prescriber. I'm the prescribee, and I should be ashamed of myself. I know I should. Is this a CYA decision?
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's okay, what I meant, to be blunt. It's basically, I don't want to get sued, so more pictures.
Okay, we're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist.
You know, Art Kaplan, we talked yesterday with Tony Kuznarek, our sports reporter from NBC Sports Boston, about this very same story.
Horrifying.
This terrible obesity scourge in the NFL that really does a number on big linemen after they retire, or maybe even while they're still playing. What's going on?
So, you know, if you are even a minor sports fan or football fan, you notice that maybe in the 1960s and 70s, the linemen weighed about 225 pounds, 245 pounds.
Yeah.
They were the big guys. Today, you got 345-pound linemen. You got an average line for college teams that's 300 pounds. So clearly, people are being told to put on weight. I still think there's got to be some drug use rattling around that no one wants to discover, but put that on the side. You put that kind of weight on your joints and you are going to get all kinds of trouble. And while we're all consumed with worrying about concussions, if you looked at the number of players who get knee injuries and who suffer from joint injuries or our old friend, diabetes, it's big, and then these linemen and guys who are these huge weights have a really hard time changing their habits once they retire. And, you know, most of these linemen are going to have careers that are 4 or 5 years, so it's not a huge career in the NFL. And if you can't change your habits over the next 4 or 5 years, then you get all the diseases of obesity. So the NFL loves the big guys. Fans like watching all the big guys collide or, you know, block each other. It's kind of our version of, what do you call it, sumo wrestling.
Yeah.
But it comes at a big, big price, a price that's a little bit hidden because we're all worried about concussion. But I don't know, just adding up joint replacement and diabetes costs, enormous. League doesn't seem to care.
Well, they didn't care about concussions either, and they still don't,
right,
until they were forced to by litigation and public embarrassment. And hopefully this terrific story in the New York Times, if you want to read it out there, the NFL's Obesity Scourge is the title. Hopefully this will embarrass them as well. Speaking of embarrassment,
I mean, here's an idea, just tossing something out. I know all our NFL football fans would like it, but the NFL could set weight limits on the top end.
No, it could also.
I mean, it could be like nobody bigger than 300 pounds. I'm just making up something. But, you know, we don't have to have this continuing escalation into the 400-pound lineman.
No, but it could also, if people are going to do that, these people are adults, even though the story makes it clear that they start being told that you should eat till you faint when you're in high school and college. At minimum, as a starting point, they should provide a whole spectrum of nutrition and health and exercise and whatever else until these men are able to return to some normal weight and normal health. So your thing is a better idea, but it's not going to happen. And the hope is that at least they'll be forced to pay.
It ain't going to happen.
In any case. So Art, a little bit later, we're going to talk to Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen about their new cookbook in concert with National Geographic. It's called Tasting Italy. So before we talk about things that are probably not the healthiest, but they taste fabulous, what's with this planetary health diet thing? Describe it and then say whether it passed the laugh test as to whether or not this could become adopted by any serious part of the world.
So it's interesting. You know, we hear a lot about the Trump administration sort of not being on board climate change. We get a lot of talk about climate denial. And it sounds like the only way to get after climate warming and climate change is to have government issue regulations and restrict coal and smokestack emissions and cut back on this, that, and the other thing. And I'm not against any of that, and I think climate change is real, and I think we should do those things. But we could change our lifestyles, and this UN report came out and said if we went to a diet, basically, that relied on less meat and less sugar, we would have a big impact on not just us, but climate. Why? Because animals basically consume lots and lots of corn and stuff, and they make methane through the digestive process, and the whole meat thing has got a huge impact in terms of runoff into our rivers and streams, and being able to make the world safe for corn is another corn syrup kind of thing, which uses vast quantities of water and has bad impacts on the environment too. So if we all ate less meat and we all ingested less sugar, then we would be healthier, and it has a boon to climate. Do I think it has a chance? Little bit. I mean, I do think people are starting to think harder about their sugary beverages and all that sort of stuff. And I think probably a lot of folks are actually eating a little bit less meat. So,
yeah, but doesn't that maybe? Marjorie hates it when I say that we need government intervention in things. And I always say, you know that you need government intervention when we as individuals are unable to police ourselves. The governments would have to start reducing subsidies for unhealthy food production.
Well, that's
and
true.
Increase subsidies. But, I mean, the lobbies are so powerful. It's insane.
Well, you know,
right. People don't want to give Medicaid to people unless they're working, but we're going to subsidize farmers
exactly.
to continue to make cheese when we have more cheese on this planet than we can store in warehouses. By the way, should nuclear holocaust with the North Koreans or somebody come, I'm telling you what you're going to be eating, American cheese.
Well, you know, this diet, though, I mean, because, you know, the vegan diet, you can't have any dairy, you can't have any cheese,
yeah.
you can't have any, which is a real problem for, I really love milk and yogurt and cheese. But this diet says you can have some of that, just not, and so it's not,
yeah,
even though that's bad.
You have to cut your meat consumption 50%.
Well, I don't care.
Most Americans
yeah.
are, sadly, and I am amongst them, are big-time meat eaters.
Yeah. But
well, you know, you go to some of these places where they've got you basically eating out of a trough, you know, the chain restaurant things, and there's it ain't the diet that's being proposed here. And I know we're talking in the middle of an obesity epidemic, but it does add another reason to at least think about changing your diet a little bit, when you realize it's got the climate impact too.
So, Art Kaplan, we only have about 2 or 3 minutes for this. You and I have debated these right to try proposals that a lot of states have, I think, every handful of months. It's up again today because the feds passed a law finally being implemented. Can you explain what it is and explain to me one more time why someone who's terminal should not be able to use whatever drug he or she wants if they can get the company to provide it? Remind me. You wrote a great piece, by the way, even though I'm still unconvinced, but you did write a fine piece. No, I mean, you did. It was a really powerful piece. Go ahead.
So basically, states and the federal government have passed laws that say if you're dying, you ought to be able to get any drug you want, and that's the law. The reason the laws are stupid is they don't oblige anybody to give you anything. So, yes, if I'm in a bad mood, I'll say you now have the right to beg, which you had before anybody passed any laws. This is just feel-good legislation. Trump and Pence promoted it and said it would save thousands of lives. Law has been in the books, at least the federal law, for about a year. You know how many people have gotten anything from that law?
One.
Estimate zero.
Oh,
maybe
zero.
One, maybe one. Yeah, I think it's zero. There's an argument about whether there's one. I don't even think the one that's alleged is a case. But put that on the side. It's basically nobody. And the laws don't do the job. So that's one problem. Second, and to get to the other thing that you asked about, you can't just throw drugs that are brand new and only tested in mice into people. You need to know the dose. You need to know something about how often to give it during the day. You need to know how to administer it. So to get that minimal information, you got to test it a little bit in some humans. Now, that would be fine to test it on dying people or whoever, but you don't just give it out willy-nilly. You got to collect information. If you don't do that, you never know what you're doing. So that's the short answer. even if a drug has been tested in animals, it doesn't mean you know what to do with it in a person until you study it for a bit. So I'm all for studying it for a bit, but you can't pretend like, hey, I'm going to give you X amount of this because it cured cancer in a rat, and good luck to you. But you'll probably just kill the person.
And do you argue in your piece, which I read late last night, that there's some FDA expanded access program that maybe fills that? What does it do exactly?
So FDA has a program that says if you're really sick, we'll waive off some of the usual restrictions to get into a clinical trial, and it can be tested on you. It comes from the AIDS era. Remember all that activism to say, test drugs on us, you know, we're dying anyway. So they built this program, and it works. You don't need the right to try legislation, and I'm going to come back to the fact that I know you don't need it because it doesn't work.
Okay.
What's the Everyday Ethics Podcast, Art?
We are going to take a look at the Covington Catholic situation of, you know, what does it mean to sort of face off or get involved with or act in an oddball way relative to a Native American or somebody of a different culture? I don't know what the heck happened with these young men from that high school, but I do know that people sort of think things are acceptable facing off against one another when maybe they're not quite as acceptable depending upon who's involved.
You know, we haven't discussed this on the show, but Marjorie, do you want to share with Art before he goes what your perspective is on the school itself?
Well, I was saying to Jim, you know, it's been a tough few years for Catholicism, it's been a tough few years too, tough few months for Catholic high schools. So we had the sexcapades, the beer-soaked sexcapades with Brett Kavanaugh's Georgetown Prep High School, and now we got this Covington Catholic thing where, I mean, I wrote a column about this for The Globe. It's going to run tomorrow or Friday. Catholic schoolboys should know a little bit better than to wear MAGA hats. Because the president is not exactly down, with the exception of the Catholic Church's stands on pro-life stuff.
And they wouldn't know it except for the fact that it's clear, Marjorie, that Catholicism is degenerated into libertinism, right? I mean, they're just running amok. They've gone completely right out of their court.
Yeah, you might say so.
I'm joking. It's just a joke.
Art, it's great to talk to you.
It's just a joke.
As always.
Thank you very much. Art Kaplan is the William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Medical Division, the Division of Medical Ethics, that is, and NYU Langone Medical Center, and the co-host of the Everyday Podcast. Up next, Senator Elizabeth Warren is refining her populist message and pitching it to the residents of Puerto Rico. WGBH reporter Adam Riley joins us from San Juan, Puerto Rico, where he's been following her campaign. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, Adam Riley calls in from San Juan, where he's been following Elizabeth Warren's 2020 campaign. We'll ask him if her populist pitch is winning over the people of Puerto Rico. If the government shutdown has affected your travel plans, we've got another way to get you abroad. America's Test Kitchen's latest cookbook, it's called Tasting Italy. I'd love to. A culinary journey. Chef and food author Jack Bishop joins us for that.
National security expert Juliette Kime is here to talk about the Supreme Court's decision to implement Trump's controversial ban on transgender military personnel. Then Cy Montgomery for this month's edition of the Afternoon Zoo, with a look at how scientists have found a princess charming for lonely Bolivian frog. That will wrap things up with WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen and his take on some historic moments out of this year's Oscar nominations. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. So Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, has taken her 2020 presidential campaign, even though it isn't official yet, to San Juan, taking her populist economic message along for the ride.
For a long time now, I have been talking about how Washington works hard for the wealthy and the well-connected, but it isn't working for anyone else. And Puerto Rico, San Juan, and the University of Puerto Rico are all examples of what goes wrong when government isn't working for the people.
WGBH's Adam Riley on yet another tough assignment joins us on the line from San Juan, where he's been tracking Senator Warren's 2020 campaign. Adam, great to talk to you.
Great to
Hey, guys, back at you.
Great to talk to you too, Adam. So how's she doing down there, and why is she there?
I think she did pretty well. She only had one public event. It was last night. It was at this gorgeous 200-year-old theater called the Teatro Tapia, right in the middle of the Old Town in San Juan. I don't know if you guys have been here before. This is my first time.
I have not.
And the Old Town, for listeners who, it's almost like a tropical Quebec city. It reminded me a little bit of Prague, just really, really old, gorgeous buildings, incredibly atmospheric. So she's right in the thick of it. And she gave a speech last night, which I thought was the most locally focused of any speech I've seen her give. When I followed her in Iowa and when I saw her in New Hampshire last Friday, she doesn't do a lot of the, you know, hey, let's talk about ethanol, or hey, isn't it great that you can live free or die in this state? She doesn't pander usually. And I'm not saying she was pandering here, but she spent a lot more time than she usually does talking about issues of intense local interest, like the hurricane recovery or lack thereof, like the huge debt load that Puerto Rico is carrying and why the island can't discharge the debt load and declare bankruptcy like companies could or American cities could. And also about the question of statehood or independence. She said she thinks Puerto Rico should be able to determine the nature of its relationship to the U.S., which seems like she's saying basically whatever you guys want to do, whether you want to stick with the U.S., become a state, or maybe go your own way is A-okay with me. So that's how she differed last night. And I would say that the response was really broadly enthusiastic. People like to talk about those issues here. It's such an unusual spot. They have concerns that a lot of states don't, simply by dint of being a territory that can't vote in the presidential election, for example. And most of the people I talked to were really happy to hear her hone in on these issues and do it in a way that shows that she knows what she's talking about, because she's been interested in Puerto Rico's status for a while, and that's something I heard again and again.
Well, yeah, when you mentioned she's interested in the status, and you mentioned a pretty important point is they don't have any electoral votes. They can vote in the primary. You know, I sit here and, well, let me play a little bit here, and then I'll ask the question. Part of what she said, she's basically accusing President Trump of betraying the island as it struggles to recover from both Hurricanes Maria and Irma. Here she is.
3,000, maybe more, of your brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, neighbors, were killed by the storm and its aftermath. And 16 months later, the people of Puerto Rico have not received the help they deserve.
Now, this is going to come out much more crassly than I mean, because obviously she cares about Puerto Rico. She was there with that Massachusetts delegation, I guess, it was almost exactly a year ago. But was it to speak to the people of Puerto Rico, or is it to speak through the people of Puerto Rico as using Puerto Rico as a stage for a place where not only has Donald Trump not done what he said he did, two, totally misrepresented the death toll, upsetting a lot of people, and three, is now contemplating diverting relief funds from Puerto Rico to pay for what she called his dumb wall last night in Puerto Rico. Which is it, do you think, Adam?
That's a great way of formulating it, and I think it's both at the same time, and this gets back to Marjorie's question of why she's here. You are right that Trump's response to Puerto Rico and the hurricanes and, you know, the misstating the death toll. And remember, there's that infamous video of him. What was he sort of shooting like basketballs? Was it rolls of
paper towels
out into the audience, just looking like he didn't give a word I can't say on air. I think for a lot of Democrats and a lot of people on the left, the way Trump has responded to Puerto Rico is, along with everything he said about Mexico and illegal immigrants coming across the border, kind of embodies what they believe to be his racism and his desire to stoke animosity against people of color for political gain, which is something that Warren mentioned last night. So by coming here, there's incredible symbolic efficiency in making this visit to Puerto Rico, not just because a lot of people think the recovery is lagging horribly, and not just because the island's struggling with this huge debt load that it can't get on top of, and you know, is having austerity measures imposed from Washington, but also because, Jim, as you said, now the president's talking about taking disaster relief funding and putting it toward the wall. So it touches on, I think, one of the central grievances that so many Americans have with the president. And it's a way of signaling early on in the campaign that she is attuned to a certain set of Latino political issues, which is not a bad thing to do either as a white woman from Oklahoma.
You know, Adam, I probably should know this, but I don't. But Jim pointed out that very few people in Puerto Rico speak English. I think it's what
speak
you said.
It proficiently. Well, yeah. Well, both English and Spanish, I looked it up this morning, are the official languages. Fewer than 20%, according to the census, are proficient in English.
Yeah, what I don't know is whether Warren speaks any Spanish. Did you hear her speak any Spanish?
She did not bust out any Spanish that day. And I think that's, you know, those are the moments, as you guys know, those are the moments that can really kind of be disastrous for a candidate when they look like they're trying to be authentic or show that they're down with the people they're speaking to, and they try a little bit too hard. She didn't do that. She did do her, her stock approach to a new city. It's sort of like a classic rock band. She'll say, "Hello, City X," and then she'll give a joyful whoop. And she did say, "Hello, San Juan," and whoop like that. But no attempts to speak Spanish that I saw. Now she made, I think, at least one private visit that the press wasn't invited along for earlier in the day. So maybe she did there, but I didn't see it.
You know, when you think about Elizabeth Warren, one advantage I think she does have is that she's been banging the same drum for like 20 years. I mean, she and her daughter wrote that book years and years ago about the middle two-income middle-class trap, how people can't afford the middle class. This was long before she ran for Senate. So she does have a raison d'etre, a pretty powerful one that she keeps saying is her whole life's work. And that is true.
Yeah, I think her consistency, when you compare her to, you know, I think Kamala Harris, there was a piece in the New York Times talking about how she is sort of something of a cipher, how it's hard to know what she believes on some fronts. And that can be advantageous because people can then decide to impute whatever beliefs to you that they might happen to have themselves. But it can also make people question what the core is. And one of the people I spoke with last night, a woman who's a communication strategist and advocate here in Puerto Rico, said that when she talks about this stuff, you can just tell she's speaking from her gut, not just the issues involving Puerto Rico, but also this notion that she says again and again, and I'm glad you guys picked the bite you did at the outset, that Washington works well for the wealthy and well-connected and not for everyone else. This is what she believes. There's not a lot of coyness in her presentation, and a lot of people respond well to that.
Yeah, but while I agree with both you and Marjorie, while consistency is obviously very appealing, it's also advantageous, like Senator Gillibrand, to have gotten an A from the NRA and now getting an F from the NRA for have been against comprehensive immigration for reform, and now she's for comprehensive immigration.
That's kind of what I meant. I mean, you cannot say that Elizabeth Warren hasn't had a set of principles that she has stuck to for year after year. I mean, how many times we all used to make fun of her during the race with Scott Brown and later on with the – who'd you run against the next time? Oh, Jeff Deal.
Mm-hmm.
The hammer middle class.
The hammer
middle class over and over. We've all heard about Oklahoma and her janitor father and her mother having to go to work and he had a heart attack. I mean, we all know the story by heart.
So, Adam.
And not to get.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, not to get too far afield, but, you know, Jim, you bring up the question of switches that politicians make, and Marjorie, you did too, that are maybe not credible. If you can tell a credible story about why you moved from point A to point B, that's fine. But remember when President Obama. What was, do I remember correctly that he had supported gay marriage as a state legislator and then opposed it in the Senate and then came around to supporting it again as president? That kind of evolution story is tough, and that's not a problem that Warren seems to face.
So speaking of, you're in Puerto Rico, and we're probably remiss in not asking the most important question, which is how are things in the way, well, Irma and Maria were not that recent. They weren't that far long ago either. How are conditions there?
I have to be totally honest with you. Because I've never been here before, I can't say what I am seeing now is new post-hurricane and what is the way it was. There, you know, when you come into the city, I hadn't known this. There, you know, there's this gorgeous old town. There's many parts I haven't seen, but there's also some real palpable poverty in certain pockets as you're heading from the airport to where Warren gave her speech. I don't think, based on conversations I've had, that is hurricane aftermath stuff. The cameraman we work with, a videographer who lives here, said that by and large, San Juan wasn't really hit hard. It was other parts of the island that were. But I got to plead a degree of ignorance here because I don't exactly know what it looked like before.
Well, Adam Riley, let me ask you a totally superficial question as we all came in the snow and ice this morning.
Those are my favorites.
Yeah, so. I'm wondering, what's the temperature down there? Are you wearing shorts and a T-shirt?
I am not. I've actually, because of my passion for public media, been hunkered down in my hotel room working this morning. But it is absolutely beautiful. It is like, I'm going to say upper 80s and sunny. I'm outing myself here. I stepped outside briefly this morning, and I'm looking forward to getting back out. It's a really nice change from what we left behind in Massachusetts on Tuesday. And I say we in part, I should mention this to you guys. So Elizabeth Warren flew on my JetBlue flight down from Boston. And I got to say, there is something unusual still, even though I've seen her live before, there's something unusual about seeing a public figure like that, a prominent public figure, in the exact same context that a whole bunch of ordinary people are. You know, you're walking down the aisle and then, oh, hey, it's Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, she's just kind of sitting there, and people said hi to her, and she said hi to some people, but, you know, she's just another passenger on the flight.
In economy?
So,
was she in economy?
I don't believe she upgraded to, what is JetBlue when they give you, quote, even more room or something? I don't think she was in a fancy aisle.
Okay.
Although I should check on that because we could blow the lid off this thing.
So, you know, speaking of how you got down there, how much local press is following her? And by the way, I think it's fabulous that both the people who run our newsroom and you decided to do this. I think it's terrific. How much local press is down there besides you, and how much national press? Because literally minutes ago, I see her trip on CNN.
I know that CNN, and I believe MJ Lee is the reporter, has been covering her campaign really, really aggressively. I didn't see as much of a press, massive press, broadly speaking, as I have at other stops. I think that, you know, that Iowa trip, because it was her first one when she formed the Exploratory Committee. That was the one where kind of like every big name journalist I could think of, whether it's print, radio, TV, they all seem to be there. Not quite as much this time around. And I don't think that people like her a lot and people know her a lot down here. I'm not sure she has the same level of political celebrity that she does in the U.S., but that's based on a really small sample size. And if I'm right, it might be just because the reality here is, you know, that they are very much in their own reality. They're in the U.S., but not of it. So that might explain that.
You know, if I remember correctly, when she announced as quickly as she did, well, she formally is not a candidate, but her exploratory effort, I think I either said on the air or said to Marjorie off the air, boy, isn't it a little early to be doing this? And if I did say that, how wrong I was to have said that, because she is getting so much play while other candidates are announcing. Most recently, Harris and CNN is promoting that they're doing a town hall with her in Iowa. Warren is actually campaigning big time, and whether it's Iowa or New Hampshire, I know you've been all these places, and Puerto Rico, it does give her a pretty significant leg up in the early going, no?
I think you're right, and I was similarly not skeptical maybe, but just slightly confused when she kicked it off as early as she did. But, yeah, she's become the person who is driving the presidential narrative on the Democratic side at this point in time. She's the one that, you know, the president is driving at. She's the one who's being asked to weigh in when other candidates get in the race. How do you feel about Kamala Harris? You know, how do you feel about whoever else? So it's a nice way to control, to the extent that you can in something like this, to control her own destiny, which, yeah, I don't think she probably would have been able to do in the same way if she'd waited until March or April or something like that. By the way, you guys have probably mentioned this, but she's off to South Carolina tonight. So she checks off a Latino box, you know, not D, but a Latino box with a trip to Puerto Rico. She has South Carolina, where African-Americans are going to play a huge role in another early voting state. Our colleague Soraya Winter-Smith is going to be down there covering that for GBH. So, and then, you know, she's already done New Hampshire, obviously, but she's also done Iowa to make the case to people in the Midwest. So she's checking off a whole lot of important boxes, as you said, really early on.
One last thing, Adam, is if I read, I don't know if it was announced in Puerto Rico, I assume if I'm right that she did announce it there or re-announce it there, is she proposed some sort of commission a la 9/11 to look into
she
how
has.
The federal government dealt with Irma and Maria? She has.
That was one of a number of call she made last night. She called for a 9/11 style commission to look into the administration's response. She called for the resignation of the FEMA head. I don't want to get it wrong, but I believe it's Brock Long. Am I right about
I'm
that?
I'm not sure what his last name is.
Okay, but the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, she called for a Marshall Plan for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. When she was pressed on that, she didn't get into fine-grained detail, but that was an idea she threw out there. And also, she mentioned auditing Puerto Rico's debt, which I think is $70 billion, and then you've got, I believe, $50 billion of pension obligations. She's not sure that that the sources of that debt have been examined and scrutinized the way they should be. She doesn't like that a lot of the debt is held by Wall Street investors, of course, so it fits perfectly into her narrative. But, yeah, she had a bunch of very specific policy proposals where Puerto Rico is concerned.
By the way, the guy's name is Brock Long. I'm sorry we didn't know. I know you got to go because you're off to the Dominican Republic or wherever you're going next.
I thought
on
it was Turks
international
and Caicos.
Tour. Hey, Adam, great
is she
reporting.
Going out there? I hear that's really nice.
We
too.
Really appreciate your time, Adam.
Thanks,
we'll see you
Adam.
Back in the
Thanks
newsroom
for
soon.
Me.
Thanks.
WGBH Adam Riley is a reporter for radio and TV at WGBH, along with Peter Cassis. He co-hosts the Scrum Political Podcast, and he is in San Juan covering Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign. She's off to South Carolina next. WGBH's Soraya Wintersmith will be covering that campaign stop. You can hear more about that this afternoon on All Things Considered.
You know, Marjorie, do you mind if we stay on this just for a couple of minutes? Because I don't remember the exact firm that did the polling, and my apologies, whoever it was. Somewhere north of 60%, I think it was 65% or something, of the people polled in Massachusetts right before the election in which the Senator Warren beat Jeff Deal, said they didn't want her to run for president.
Right.
And that's a huge majority in her home state. And I'm curious to know whether people feel the same way now that she's out on the campaign trail doing this populist message thing, as Adam said, in Iowa, New Hampshire, Puerto Rico. She's on her way to South Carolina. So if it's okay with you, let's spend 10 minutes at 877-301-8970. How do you feel about a recently reelected Senator Elizabeth Warren running for president? And if you were among the roughly, I think it's roughly two-thirds of people in Massachusetts, likely voters, who said in a poll that you didn't want her to run for president. Has your view changed because of how she's performed on the trail over the first, I don't know what it is, several weeks of her campaign with a pretty powerful populist anti-Trump message, which one would think would have great appeal in Massachusetts? 877-301-8970.
You know, we're getting a few emails about the Achilles heel that many of us think she has, this whole mess with the Native American stuff. On the other hand, If she were to prevail and she were to do well in the primaries and go up against Trump, he's done so many disreputable things that might kind of make the Native American thing pale by comparison. And then we get
his approval ratings down to 37% in the CNN poll.
I know. Well, you know, I mean, you seem to be selling out when they're looking at you for treason from the FBI, like selling us out to the Russians. That's not a good
43% of Republicans in that same poll. Republicans in the same poll said building the wall is not worth the price of shutting down the government.
And Marcia gets to a point I made when we were talking with Adam that this has been her whole life's work. Mm-hmm. He says we should get a hold of the interview she did with Bill Moyers about 10 years ago, talking about abuses of credit card companies and disproportionate impact on single mothers. And, you know, I've always said that would be such a great thing to run on. Why are we paying? What are the interest rates now in a house? Like 4%, 3%, 5%, something
like
that?
You mean mortgage rates?
Yeah, mortgage rates.
I think in the 4 range.
Okay. Why are we paying 18, 19, 20% on your Visa and MasterCard? Because, once again, Congress does nothing about it. They could.
877-301-8970. So how do you feel about, again, she was just reelected, and as I said, somewhere in the neighborhood, two-thirds of you, even if you voted for her, which obviously a majority did, didn't want her to run for president. Has the actual experience, she's not formally running, but she's essentially running, has the actual experience of watching her run for the presidency, has that caused you to join what was a minority, I think, in October, who felt that she shouldn't be? Jackie and Haverhill, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi. Hi, Jackie.
I'm in Haverhill. I love Senator Warren. I voted for her, but now she should stay in Washington and work on the wall and the shutdown. And if she eventually runs for president, That would be great if she could say, point to that as something she contributed to.
So what, but I don't understand, if you think that if she eventually ran for president, that's a good thing, why should she not run if you admire her this round?
Well, I go back and flip-flop on this because I do like her and I like her, you know, policies and everything. But she is unfairly, and it's maddening, but she's been painted, you know, in the corner that she's in as far as being too this or too that. And there might be somebody else that could, you know, be better able to win the hearts of the American people and win the presidency.
Well, you know, Jackie, you should read a column Marjorie wrote a couple of weeks ago about a Warren/Ocasio-Cortez agenda that is not out of the mainstream, critics suggest.
I think conservatives like to call her far left, far left, far left. Well, most Americans now would like to get Medicare for all, so she's not far left on that.
Poll this morning on the Hill,
majority. Most Americans think that they got ripped off on this last tax cut when you look at polls. So I think that
the majority support a top rate. Warren is not supporting, as far as I know. I don't know if she is or not, but the Ocasio-Cortez, what I would argue, is the most, quote, radical proposal of them all.
Why is it that radical when she's talking about not even people that make $10 million, but the people that make $1 above $10 million, and they pay the 70% on that dollar above?
Well, it's obviously not that radical because the majority of people support it.
There's a lot of polling, and I know you can say, oh, polls, they're always wrong. Well, they're not always wrong, but sometimes they're off. But there's a lot of polling that shows that America is moving left on a lot of issues because, as I've said, the emperor has no clothes. They're not doing anything wrong. They can't afford a home. They can't afford college. They can't afford their medicine. We just talked about this with Art Kaplan. And I think that sort of the jig is up. I mean, I think it maybe took us 40 years to realize. But
you know that's the name of Stormy Daniels' book. Do you know that? The emperor has no clothes.
The emperor has no clothes. By the way, I saw Sherrod Brown on TV. A lot of people think that he could get someplace,
too. You know who you'd vote for? His wife. Who's a big-time column? No, gorgeous.
Oh, she's a journalist.
She is a big-time gorgeous. She's a big-time columnist, and she shares your worldview. Yeah. Connie Schultz, I think her name is.
Connie
Leanna
Schultz,
Carr,
exactly.
You're next on Boston Public Radio. Should she be running, Elizabeth Warren? Hi. Hi, Lee. It's going well so far. Lee, we'll put you on hold. Jack in Somerville, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Should she be running? Hi, Jack.
She should. I love Elizabeth Warren. I love the things she's saying. I don't think she has a chance of winning, but I'd like to see her run and pull the field to the left.
Why doesn't she have a chance of winning?
Well, look, Michael Dukakis and Al Gore and John Kerry, all these Northeastern-style liberals who are a bit stiff, you know, sort of lacking charisma of a sort that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had, I don't think a lot of people are going to go for her, but I really love what she says and does.
Well, you know, can I tell you something? I've seen her speak in front of large crowds. And while I'm, as I think listeners know, a huge admirer of Michael Dukakis and the other people you mentioned, you would not say she is charisma free.
Oh, no.
If you ever saw her.
No, she's a good, as we say, retail politician. I saw her at an event with Ed Markey, who's been a politician for a long time. And no offense to Ed Markey, but.
Well, he's not. He doesn't have that kind of thing.
She gets everybody revved up in a way that Markey can't. And you know what I think?
Jack, thanks for the call.
Again, I keep going back to the same theme, but we elected Jimmy Carter. I mean, what an unlikely guy to be elected president of the United States. But it was a reaction to what? It was a reaction to Richard Nixon. We have a history of this. We went from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. It's something.
You
that
wrote that column in the New York Times and said I missed the whole thing and I should have seen it coming for exactly that reason.
David
Axelrod.
Yes.
Exactly.
So now you have a guy
of
that's
Obama
up
fame.
To his eye teeth in scandals and not kept his promises in terms of helping the middle class and all this kind of stuff. She's on the other side. She's a woman, and she's someone who's got this, you know, a political passion for where the country is moving right now. So that's one of the things I think she's got in her wheelhouse, even though, you know, she, like I said before, she's got this problem with the Native American
thing. Hillary in Arlington, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am all for Elizabeth Warren as a candidate. I think she has fantastic policies. And I really want journalists to take responsibility for keeping the discussion off of likability. I think that is such a non-starter in terms of who our president is. And I feel like more time happens on air, even on
No, we did it here, too. We did it. We're guilty, too. Go ahead, Hillary.
Yeah, I want journalists, every time that issue comes up, to say, why are we talking about this? Let's talk about her policies and how they're going to affect the country.
Well, Hillary, the only place where I disagree with you, and maybe the likability thing as such is inappropriate, people have to feel good about the messenger, in my opinion. And maybe likability is the wrong word, if they are going to buy the message, and at least in most of American politics. And so some of the personal trait issues that you may, and by the way, I wish you were right, should be irrelevant, and their position on the issue and their ability to get things done should be first and foremost. Would you not agree that you have to feel good, whatever that means, about the person delivering the message, even if the message is perfect?
I just never hear journalists saying, let's stop talking about likability for a minute and talk about her policies and how they will affect the country.
Well, Hillary, Marjorie Egan, standing about 3 feet away from me, has been talking about these policies, at least on this show, nonstop.
They don't.
But
I think Hillary's got a great point. When you turn on the cable news at night, you're not hearing this. You're not hearing it. You might hear it more on MSNBC because I would imagine they would be big fans of Elizabeth Warren. But you don't hear it much. You don't hear policy talk much on the other stations. But the other thing about the likability is that there's a lot of women running now. So mostly we debate the likability of women.
Almost
exclusively. We do sometimes men. It's true. People said that John Kerry wasn't very likable.
Excuse me. People said John Kerry.
I asked
Marjorie Egan asked the first question.
I know.
In one of the Curry Weld debates.
Yep.
She was on the panel, People. And Marjorie Egan's first question for Senator John Kerry in the highest profile Senate race in America is, Senator, why does nobody like you?
Well, it was a big issue in that race when he ran against Bill Weld.
Yeah, I think it was.
But typically, you know, it's a funny – I forget who did the thing that was really funny that they said, you know – there was just something about, I'm not against women, but there was something about Hillary Clinton. And
it was a McSweeney thing we talked about.
Great.
Yeah,
and now I'm looking at Elizabeth Warren and I don't
know. Can't stand her either.
Something. And Kamala Harris, I can't quite figure it out. So now.
But I love a woman candidate.
I just don't
like these women.
So when you go down the list of four or five women and you don't like any of them, then you have to wonder, you know, what exactly is going on. And I don't know how many people could say that they like Donald Trump. I'm not
Here's
sure.
Here's the line. Our coworker just typed it in. This is verbatim
from
this
great
piece. I don't hate women candidates. I just hated Hillary. And coincidentally, I'm starting to hate Elizabeth Warren, too.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
Brilliant. Google it. It is really, really funny. We have time for one more quick one. Diane in Cambridge, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think Marjorie was right just now when she said that it's sexism. And I think here in Massachusetts, we are absolutely so lucky to have a wonderful, wonderful qualified senator like Elizabeth Warren. I love her. I think she would make an excellent president. I think she's well-placed and really knowledgeable enough to clean up the mess that Trump and his cronies are making in Washington and across the country. I'm just worried about what Marjorie was referring to. I'm worried about sexism. And it is just too important. We just have to get Trump out. It is too important. So I'm just questioning that. Would sexism jeopardize a Democratic win for president in 2020?
And can I give you my quick answer to that question? I think if Hillary Clinton was not one of the worst candidates in American history, she'd be president of the United States in a walk over a Donald Trump.
And she had tons of baggage left over from her husband, and she didn't have this kind of cause. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is a mission-driven person.
That is true.
The only thing is she's got to up her debating skills, because if you saw her debating Jeff Deal.
Well, he was pretty good in the debates, yeah.
He was very good, and it was not they were not good nights for Elizabeth Warren.
In the control room, is this line on the Comrex screen also from the piece? Here's another piece from this story that Marjorie is citing. Don't get me wrong. I've heard that Elizabeth Warren is a champion of consumers in the middle class who battled the big banks and advocates for economic reform. Nonetheless, she just rubs me the wrong way. It is one of the best and funniest pieces ever. Thanks for your calls. We appreciate it.
Okay, coming up, America's Test Kitchen. Jack Bishop is here to talk about their new cookbook. He is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie, and the team at America's Test Kitchen, in collaboration with National Geographic, have brought Italy's culture, landscapes, and authentic cuisine together by way of 100 regional recipes and a new beautiful and terrific cookbook. It's called Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey. Jack Bishop joins us in Studio 3 to talk about it. He's a chef, food author, and chief creative officer. I don't even know what that means, of America's Test Kitchen, but he'll tell us. Jack, welcome to Boston Public Radio. It's great to see you.
It's nice to see you. Is it okay if I don't know what it means?
Well, if you don't, we won't even ask.
I'm dying to know what you think about this. When Jim and I were talking about talking to you this morning, we were saying, you know, everybody always says, and we've always said, we've both been lucky enough to go to Italy a few times, that it's got the best cooking and food in the world. Is that true, or is it just because we've never really been anyplace else? And we just, they seem to have a whole different attitude about cooking and meals and everything.
So I think it's true. And here's,
you
I'm
do.
Going to support it with the following suppositions.
Okay.
I'm not going to call them facts, but we'll number one, food has a more central place in Italian life than in most cultures. You know, the French might argue there, and they, but I think, you know, they talk about la dolce vita. And for those of us who've been lucky enough to be in Italy or to have lived in Italy, we know that food is central. The whole day is organized around what you are eating. The other thing is the quality of the ingredients is amazing. Not only the artisanal foods, the Parmigiano, the balsamico, I think the vegetables and the fruit, they get more locally grown. The climate is wonderful. The soil is wonderful. The farming.
The mozzarella.
Oh, yeah.
God.
So, and when you start with great ingredients, everything is so much easier in the kitchen.
You know what you're leaving off the list, Jack, and you know much more about this than I. They're like the sexiest meals ever also, aren't they? I mean, I don't know if it's just the culture or the casual, beautiful nature of the Italian people.
Elaborate on that,
Jim. But it's so adds.
Is the spaghetti the
I've
sexy
said to you,
or the...
No, I said to you the first time I went to Italy and I was talking to Marjorie about it, I said I'm walking down, it wasn't in Rome, I came somewhere north of Rome, and I say I'm walking down the street and I see these two people who probably are in their 80s walking down the street arm in arm, and it was like the sexiest couple I ever saw. And you go into a restaurant, it's just, am I off base? I mean, there is a feel there that I think creates an environment in which the things you talk about work even better. Am I off base or not?
No, you're not off base. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
The light in Italy is amazing.
Yeah.
The architecture, the topography, you know, all of that contributes to it. The wine also helps a little bit.
Oh, yeah, the wine. That's right. Yeah. And tell us about how you've organized all this cookbook, because you have gotten all these different areas of Italy and recipes from those areas with pictures to go with them.
Yeah, so this was a 2-year project with National Geographic where we said, well, if we took your photographs and travel essays that would bring each of the regions in Italy to life, and we go from north to south, region by region, and then we took our recipes and our food photography and our know-how, couldn't we really make an amazing book? Because I think the thing that is really interesting for Americans who've never been to Italy, it's not at all what you expect. I mean, I'm Italian-American, and I still remember that first meal in Italy, and I was like, this is not my grandma's cooking. It's really quite different. It has relationships to some of the what we think of as Italian food in the United States, but it's very different. Also, it varies tremendously from north to south.
Yes.
And, you know, it's multiple cuisines. It's not a single cuisine.
Well, you write in the foreword, which I never thought about before, but it's so obvious if you do think of it. There's no national cuisine in Italy. What is it, 20 regions? Is that what it is?
20 regions. It wasn't a nation state until 1870. And so that organizing principle of, you know, having a king like France did impacts many, many things in the cultural realm, including food. Italy was very much Balkanized. And so these regions had their own cultural traditions, their own ingredients and foods that they loved, dishes that they made. And that's still intact. I mean, I think, you know, the 20th century, 21st century commercialization, the EU, introduction of fast food, big supermarkets is having an impact in Italy. But I think it still retains more of those longstanding traditions than other places in Europe.
You know why I'm laughing? Every once in a while we have a guest in who I have not met but obviously know of. I have this out-of-body experience where Jack's just talking and looking at you. And I say to myself, that's Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen. And then I realize, oh, that's right. He's on our – the new book is called Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey. You know, what I try to do, whenever we have an author in, we both make a commitment to read as much of the book as we can out of respect, if nothing else. So, you know, so I actually made a recipe last night. I went through the book, and I don't get nervous because it was great. I picked the simplest recipe by far, which was the warm anchovy and garlic dip. That is – literally, she doesn't like anchovies, or I would have brought it in for today. It knocks your socks off. I forget, what region is that from, and what's the whole genesis of that thing?
Yeah, so this is, the Italian is bagna cauda, warm bath. And it really is as much garlic and olive oil forward, I find, as it is anchovies. It's from the Northwest. Pretty sure it's Piedmont. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, it is with cocktails, raw vegetables. You can dip in nice bread.
I did bread, and it is really it's heavy cream, I should say, but it is real. The taste is so. If you like anchovies, it's just a beautiful mixture of things. You know, the takeaway from this book for me, by the way, and the joint effort with National Geographic, I think, is brilliant. There sort of is like an Anthony Bourdain-ish kind of thing to this. I mean, one of the reasons we loved him so much, like everybody in America did, was because you learned about the food through the culture. And one of the things I think you've done beautifully in this book, beyond the fact that recipes are good, and they're on this one page, which I love, which is a huge thing with cookbooks, is you really do get a sort of like a visceral sense of the environment from which they came. That was obviously the goal, right?
Yeah, it was really the essays that there were two writers that National Geographic had who both lived extensively in Italy. And so they were really able to bring to life these regions. I've traveled well in Italy, but there are parts of Italy I've never been to. But I felt like reading the book and reading about the local regions, and then, of course, the pictures. We all respond to amazing photography.
God. Yeah.
And nobody does, you know, location photography like National Geographic.
You know, you also write in the foreword, Jack, that there, well, most of us have been eating Italian food since we were kids. Of course, we started with chicken parmesan or something.
Chef Boyardee.
Well, you did. I know. Well, I did too, actually, out of a can. You talk about how there's some of these dishes that most Americans would never have even heard of. And give us an example of one or two. And is that because the ingredients are unusual for us, or why is it?
So partly it can be ingredients, some local ingredient that may not have traditionally been available here, although I really feel like all of that
everything
has changed.
Is now, yeah.
You know, in the last 20 years, you can basically buy everything on the planet here in Boston and pretty much everywhere else in the United States. You know, I think it's about these local traditions. So these dishes, you know, from the north, which is the far north, the Alps. Maybe it's because I'm looking out now on gray, snowy Boston. I'm thinking of the foothills of the Alps. And these dishes that I had never experienced
like
before,
what?
A soup with cabbage and these huge breadcrumbs and, you know, Savoy cabbage and ham that really feels more German or Austrian and actually reflects the fact that
they're across the border.
Across the border, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire had a big impact on this part of Italy. And so, you know, I think that's a big impact. The South. You know, parts of Calabria or Sicily that may not be that well-traveled. There's arancini. little fried rice balls with saffron rice.
Ooh.
Oh, my heavens.
Look at the look on your face.
I'm just like, I'm thinking lunch, and I'm thinking that would be good right now.
We're talking with Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen. The book is called Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey. You know, is it still true? There used to be kind of the snobism where the food in northern Italy was more sophisticated and the food in southern Italy was, you know, too much red sauce and all a bunch of peasants. Is that gone by the boards?
Well, as someone whose ancestors emigrated from Calabria, across from Sicily in the south, I'm going to say that that's not true.
Yeah. Was it ever true, or was that just a snobby kind of thing?
I think it's a snobby thing, and I actually think it's related to the fact that most American immigrants trace their roots back to southern Italy. And I actually think it's related to that prejudice. It has actually nothing to do
that
with Italy,
is
but is about how Italian Americans were perceived here.
Did most of the immigrants from Italy come from southern Italy?
Calabria, Sicily, Naples.
Wow.
I've seen stats that, you know, over 80% of the immigrants, because those were the poor regions of Italy, and those were people living there. They had reasons to get on boats and change their lives.
So, Jack Bishop, one of the reasons I made the simplest recipe was because I knew I could do it. And I always believe that a cookbook author, or whatever you are here, a cookbook leader in this case, should be saying to people, here's where you should start if you're just like a, I'm like a C cook, meaning I can follow a recipe. I'm like C the letter, not S-E-A. I can follow a recipe pretty well if it's not terribly complex. But my experience is always, if I have a good first experience, like I did with that anchovy and garlic dip, I'm much more likely to try something a little bit more complex. Give us a couple of examples of 100 recipes. What, for the average home cook like me, what would not be too daunting in your estimation that tastes fabulous?
So all the pasta dishes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you know how to cook pasta, you can make all of these sauces. And so, you know, the filled dishes. Mm-hmm. There's a potato gnocchi.
I saw that.
Which, again, thinking about, you know, the weather and wintry, and it's got this cheesy sauce. And potato gnocchi, I think, are actually, of all of the filled pastas or handmade pastas, they're not filled, but I put them in the same category as tortellini or ravioli, is the easiest. And so maybe that. And then for dessert, I'm thinking the chocolate hazelnut cake that also comes from the Northwest, and that just has, it's a single layer, no frosting, little dusting of powdered sugar, and that for baking, it is a perfect taste of Italy in the afternoon, let's say 4 o'clock.
Italy in the afternoon. I love that.
You know,
I love that.
It's that time of day.
We're talking with Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen. Can I deviate from the book for just a second? You've got millions of people watch America's Test Kitchen, but not everybody necessarily that's listening to us has watched it. So give people a taste of what you guys do.
So to speak.
Yeah, so we're 200 food-obsessed Bostonians. We're on the other side of town from you guys in this amazing test kitchen developing recipes. And we really pride ourselves on developing recipes that people can use successfully, that we are meticulous about the recipe testing, recipe writing. Our goal is, we believe that home cooking makes you healthier and happier. And that the biggest obstacle is that people don't know where to start, or they're afraid of failure. And so we are there to provide you information. Reliable recipes, reviews of supermarket ingredients, which pots and pans and knives you should be owning. We do all of that, books, television shows, magazines. And it's mostly a lot of fun because, of course, we're eating all day.
And you also come up with certain things, like your favorite finishing salt.
Yeah, well, I think actually the best finishing salt, there are two.
Okay.
At America's Test Kitchen, we love Malden, which is an English finishing salt, very flaky. Actually, in here in Boston, if you've not had the salt from Marblehead, made with local water.
Really?
Yeah, it's a revelation. It's
and what
delicious.
Makes it what makes it better? I read about that. What makes it better than your average salt?
So from a flavor perspective, salt is salt. They're all the same. It is a waste of money to put expensive salt in a pot of water. It's going to dissolve. It's all about texture. And so these flaky Malden salt from England that's a little bit crunchy, it's meant as a finishing salt at the table only, over a piece of fish, over a bowl of pasta. It's about that texture, that crunch, that salinity. And the shape of the crystals really does make a difference in how you perceive the flavor.
And you also talk about your favorite tableware and point out that you think food looks the best on white plates. So tell us about tableware and why white plates?
I think everything looks better on white. I mean, it's simple, and it lets the food take starring role.
Yeah.
And so...
I do notice when you go to a place like Crate and Barrel or something, the whole shelves are like they're all white.
Yeah. I mean, food stylists and food photographers, there's a reason why we have probably 1,000 white plates in our photo studio. It's, they work.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. You don't want some, like the wedding china people would get, you know, that with all these different flowers on it and stuff like that, it would kind of take away from the styling and the food, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that was in the era when the food wasn't very good and the plate had to do more
That's
work.
That's exactly right. So, you know, can we get back to pasta for a second? Because I'm assuming everybody out there is eating it almost nonstop. I've had my fresh phase. I'm not making it. I go to Capone's in Somerville, which is spectacular. He's spectacular. The whole family's actually great. What if you're not into fresh pasta or you don't have access to it or it's too expensive, what are the brands that you think are the ones that really are top of the line?
So this is interesting. So if you watch the show, this is what I do on the show. I'm the taste test guy. And of the hundreds, maybe at this point thousands of taste tests I've done over the last 25 years, this is one where it doesn't really matter all
that
much.
Is that really true?
Really?
Why doesn't it matter?
It is 10 times more important to cook the pasta correctly, and that's where most of the people mess up. They don't use enough water. They don't use enough salt. They cook it too long. They drain it too hard. They rinse it. They shake it out.
What does drain it too hard mean? You mean shaking the thing?
You want a little liquid attached to the pasta, and you, in fact, want to reserve a little bit of the cooking liquid in a measuring cup so that you can loosen up the sauce. And you get better adhesion. That water is starchy and helps sort of everything work together. We've done taste tests. We like Giacecco, Brillo. Those are Italian brands.
Yep.
But the American brands are not all that different. In fact, a lot of the Italian companies are using American wheat grown in North Dakota. And they are manufacturing it here in the U.S., and that's exactly what U.S. companies are doing.
Are you vegetarian, I read somewhere?
On and off. It depends.
How much are you missing out on? I mean, I know it's healthy and it's good for the planet, so don't send me angry email. But isn't it hard doing what you do to be a quasi-vegetarian?
Yeah, so I eat mostly everything. I have one daughter who's a vegetarian, one who's not. So the one who, for the last month, she's been home from college, so we've been eating, you know, vegetarian, which I love. For me, the best part of any meal, and I think Italians would say this, is about the vegetables. They tell you where you are. You know, if it's fava beans, it's April or May in Rome. And, you know, they're the cue about where we are in the cycle of cooking.
You know how jealous I'm looking at Jack here, who I haven't met before.
I've just seen on television. Chester.
Every time I've been in Italy, they literally had to carry me onto the plane. And I haven't been there. It is the best food ever. And by the way, Italian food is not my favorite food in the United States, which I think speaks even more to how incredible it is in Italy. But all you do is you get up and you eat, and then you walk around for a little bit, you eat again with wine, and then you eat again late at night, which is one
fantastic.
Of those great. I mean, what's your deal? I mean, you look totally healthy and fit, and what's the deal with you?
Luck. That would be good genetics.
Well, it's like Marjorie has the same deal.
I do exercise. I exercise every day. And one of the things about working at the test kitchen, so think about this. Dozens of people cooking all day, amazing aromas, is just because it's delicious doesn't mean I have to finish it.
That's a very good point.
Everything. Portion control is
I see you're also a fan of Iggy's bread.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's local, right?
It is.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, that's a perfect example of how much better our local ingredients in some cases have gotten. I think all of the local cheeses that come from New England are, you know, great improvement over the American cheeses. And I don't mean the yellow stuff or the orange stuff, but, domestic improvements in our food are really making a difference.
You know, I was down because we were doing this event near there. And I stopped in Italy's last week, which is packed, even when it was a lousy, freezing cold night. And you do see things in there that I've never seen before in terms of Italian cheeses and foods. Do you not?
Yeah. And you see all kinds of mostarda, which is like a pickled condiment that's a little sweet, a little spicy, that makes any like roast fish or roast meat taste better. You can get all these boutique things that, frankly, you could never find in the United States that are now in stores like Italy. And the number of pastas, I mean, there must be 10,000 boxes of pasta there.
Yeah, and the fresh pasta, too. A million different kinds of fresh pasta. You kind of don't know where to begin. It's kind of overwhelming.
I know where to begin. So is this book out yet? It is out.
It is out, yes.
It's great. You really, congratulations on it. It's really beautiful. The show is great and your book is great and you're really doing great stuff there. You don't need me to say it, but you really are, Jack. It's good to meet you.
Well, thanks for saying it anyway.
One quick thing before you go. A good bean dish. We're all supposed to be eating more beans now. What's a good bean dish from the book that you might recommend?
Nobody does beans like they do the Tuscans.
The Tuscans? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so the Italians have
Tuscany?
Yeah, so I'm thinking Tuscany. I'm thinking white beans.
White beans.
Soup. I mean, that's, with some vegetables, carrots and something leafy and green. And so I just think that's the best way to enjoy beans.
All right. I'm looking that up immediately. I'm starving.
Jack, it's great to see you. Can't believe the guy didn't bring us any food. That's what's been great. He brings us this beautiful cookbook.
No cheese.
Nothing.
No buffalo mozzarella. How do you say it over there? Buffalo. That's
what they say. You're saying it perfectly.
Okay. It's good to see you,
Jack. Thank you very much. Jack Bishop is a chef, food author, and chief creative officer at America's Test Kitchen. ATK's latest cookbook, done in collaboration with National Geographic, is Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey. It is fantastic.
It's really pretty.
You can catch America's Test Kitchen on WGBH's Create channel. You can also see their episodes online and so much more at americastestkitchen.com. Thank you so much for coming in, Jack. Up next, our national security expert, Juliet Kime, is here to talk about the ongoing battle over Trump's border wall and other national security headlines. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In July of 2017, President Trump abruptly declared, in a tweet, by the way, a ban on transgender people serving the military, saying that American forces cannot afford, quote, the tremendous medical costs and disruption of transgender service members. Yesterday, as you probably know, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of this ban, allowing the measure to go in effect while the legal battle, I think, in the Ninth Circuit over his policy continues. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over this, latest in the battle over Trump's border wall and other national security headlines, is Juliet Kime. Juliet's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School, an analyst for CNN and CEO of Zemcar. Hello, Juliet.
Hello. New hour. Same person,
yes,
new hour. Sorry about that today.
Right. No problem. So things are getting worse and worse, shutdown-wise.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? We have some possibilities this week.
We do have. There are some possibilities. They'll all be short term, but let's get these people paid. Is the most important thing. This week marks, or I guess today marks, the second paycheck that they will be impacted. And what's happening, and what you're starting to see, is of course, other agencies that have been able to pay people or other departments, thinking there's no way this thing is going to last a month, now saying, we're coming to the end of our runway as well. So hopefully there'll be a solution. But in the meanwhile, it's something that I have been talking about from the beginning, is the public safety and national security impact of it right now is now being monitored and disclosed in really, I think, important ways. We got the hints about TSA and them not showing up. They now have a 10-11% no-show rate as compared to on a normal day, which is 2%. They are calling in emergency staff to cover some of these big airports. You have Coast Guard, where the commandant of the Coast Guard did something I've never seen a commandant do, which is, he got on a video yesterday basically saying this is a joke. I mean, it's a disrespectful. Our armed forces are not getting paid. You have the FBI Alumni Association coming out with a really important document yesterday, monitoring where investigations have been impacted, and those include being able to pay informants, which is out of cash. You've got the Secret Service that, the former President George Bush is delivering pizzas because they're not getting paid. You have like food distribution centers for ICE and CBP members. I mean, this is impacting not just morale, but, when we train these people, and I've gone through the training, the number one thing is if you're going through a divorce, if you're having money problems, if your kid is sick and in the hospital, you know, these are the things that keep you from being able to focus. And what I want all listeners to remember about this wall fight is these people, the CBP, Secret Service, Coast Guard, TSA, they are our wall. That's who our wall is. I mean, these are the people protecting maritime, protecting air, protecting land, protecting law and law enforcement. They're our wall, and they're now. This is no joke. Now, this is not a and fortunately, the American public sees through Trump with the new polling today. He's lost. He's in a corner.
So, but I'm going to get back to the first thing you said. Yeah. I thought I overplayed my hand last night on TV, but maybe I didn't. When I had the New York Times story had just come out, the bare bones, yeah, saying that in addition to the vote on Trump's proposal in the Senate tomorrow, there'd be a vote on just opening the government till February 8th with no deal on the wall. And the way that originally ran in the New York Times was there was that latter thing was a joint Mitch McConnell, yes, a Chuck Schumer thing. And I was acting on television, like, well, it's clear that this is going to have the votes. They're going to reopen, and the fight, it'll be a fight another day. They probably won't shut down again. You seem to be suggesting you think something will come out of tomorrow, because I've taken a lot of heat in email,
yeah,
and text
I think
you think they will cut some
sort of deal.
I think
Schumer would not have put his name on this unless he knew that Pelosi would deliver. And so I think that there's...
I don't mean Pelosi. They need to get 60 votes. There are only 47 Democrats in the Senate.
Yeah,
I
think McConnell. Yeah, because his
really?
People are okay. looking at this polling. His people, the Republicans, are looking at this polling. This is not a Democrat problem. It's in the teens now of people who think the government should be shut down
for this wall.
Yeah. So hopefully there'll be a short-term solution. I think longer-term, Trump has backed himself into a corner, and we knew this. And Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter and the gang have put him there, and it's not... it's not Nancy Pelosi's obligation to satisfy some right wing radio talk show host, you know.
So can we move to another topic, because it has driven me nuts. And I was so glad to read a Washington Post editorial, I think it was last night, on the issue of Trump's dealings with Russia about this Trump Tower thing. Everybody knows that Rudy Giuliani said, well, the discussions went on until virtually the election. Originally, they were over in January. And then we heard from, well, it was probably till the middle of the year, and then now till the election. And, of course, the next day, his TV lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, said it was a hypothetical. But there's so much focus on the BuzzFeed Mueller thing, where Mueller said BuzzFeed was wrong, at least in some part of their report, in which they say Donald Trump told Michael Cohen a lie to Congress. Yeah. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that he didn't tell them, that BuzzFeed was dead wrong. Let me just read this one line from the Washington Post editorial. But we know Mr. Trump thought it – this is factually accurate, is their point. Forget BuzzFeed. We know Mr. Trump thought it perfectly acceptable to clandestinely pursue his personal business interest with the government of a prime U.S. adversary while advancing a presidential platform of improving relations with the regime. And they conclude in the Washington Post editorial, whether that was illegal, it was a profound betrayal of the voters. So putting BuzzFeed aside,
and he lied
this
about
story
it a million
is
times.
Unbelievable.
And he lied about it a million times.
I have
times,
no dealings
right.
with Russia. No dealings with Russia. No dealings with Russia.
And so that's I think that's exactly right. You know, you can lose, you know, in the
sight.
Details and in the indictments and in the facts and the fact checking. And as BuzzFeed writer, are they wrong? The step back moment, which is no one, and not the Trump team, is denying that these negotiations were going on. Now, whether they stopped in January, June, or September, during a significant part of the presidential campaign. And sometimes, you know, you also have to remember that Trump probably thought he was going to lose.
That's a very good point.
And so what he's clearly doing is using the platform he has to try to create a better business deal on the other side of the election. And so, you know, people say, well, why did the negotiations stop in either July or September or October? They probably stopped because Trump said, well, let's stop this now. And then when I'm not president, on the other side will renegotiate them. So Trump ran for president for the brand and the company, and he is governing for the brand and the company. And he is seeking reelection for the brand and the company in the middle of high stakes China tariff negotiations, of which the Chinese have come very far in terms of some of our complaints, and I think legitimate complaints by us. Ivanka Trump, all of a sudden, who doesn't even have a company anymore, so I don't even get this, gets approval for copyright in China. She doesn't have a company, but like I thought she went to funk. But she gets five new trademark licenses out of China. Like, you know, this is a family that is, you know, it's all about them. I've said it a million times, and not a piece of evidence has convinced me otherwise.
You know, one last thing about this. I know this is not an original thought, but this environment is so pathetically partisan. For anybody out there who is not upset by the facts that I recited from the Post editorial, which are beyond dispute, it was secret. He didn't disclose it. He's campaigning against sanctions against the entity with which he is negotiating.
Say he didn't disclose it. He lied about
it. He lied about it.
Over
but the
over.
Point is there any candidate, for those of you saying no big deal, pick a candidate you weren't crazy about as a person and tell me you would not have said this person should be drawn and quartered
right.
for this. This is
shocking.
It is shocking.
And we've lose sight of the shock because was BuzzFeed right or not? That
exactly.
He was doing it, and he misses June. And this gets back to Giuliani, you just mentioned in reference. I don't think you should call Giuliani his TV lawyer. I think you should call him his lawyer. And I think there is a strategy here to you know, Giuliani may have ruined his entire reputation. He may worry out loud, as he did in the New Yorker article, like what his epitaph will be.
Gravestone.
Did I have a gravestone? Did I lie for the president?
For
yeah. No one said that. Yeah, it's just hilarious. It's like, we're not saying that, Rudy. Why are you saying that? Is Trump continues to use Rudy Giuliani. And so he is the president's lawyer. And the president's lawyer's goal is to make us so fixated on the insanity that we lose the clarity of what you just read.
I agree.
What you just read. And so I was on air last night, and
every minute.
I know. The two lawyers.
Can you put in a word for Jim?
I will. But the two
I
lawyers
think
I was
more
on
white
with.
Men, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Good.
The two lawyers that they had on were like, oh, he's such a bad lawyer and he should fire him, whatever. And I was like, the fact that we're talking about Rudy and not talking
exactly.
about the Moscow
or
Tower,
or BuzzFeed,
right, exactly, or BuzzFeed.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move on in a second to the transgender decision because it's important. But before we do, we've discussed the Michael Cohen thing a lot. The only angle I want to pursue today, which is grossly underplayed, is in the Globe. We wake up this morning to read that Ayanna Pressley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have been added to the House Oversight Committee.
So
for
how
those,
exciting is that?
Now, for those who watch these kinds of hearings, and we're going to broadcast it live here, you generally listen to the first 10 questioners because it goes on endlessly, and it goes in seniority. So the most junior members, the Presleys and the Ocasio-Cortezes, will get to ask their questions about 14 days later.
Yeah.
Not quite literally, but everybody's going to be waiting for their questions.
Yeah,
here, Presley, Ocasio-Cortez,
nationally
questioning Michael Cohen.
Not to sound like an ageist, but we just went through the Kavanaugh hearings, and I mean, my goodness, the guy Grassley from Iowa is like 85. Everybody's like, you know, ancient, and you're going to have this young whippersnapper who's 29 years old.
Yeah,
right there.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic. And also, so a couple things on that. So one is, I think that the first hearing is going to be about the security clearances at the White House, which is brilliant because it doesn't get to a specific case. It gets to Jared, Michael Cohen, Mike Flynn and others. And so you don't have to like focus on a specific case. You're just like, okay, why didn't any of you get your security clearances and then let them figure it out? So that will be fun. And I think it's so important to have you know, AOC and Presley on committees like this because, you know, they really are not, you know, they're not beholden to anyone. And that's what you want right now. You just want these free agents. Let Pelosi guide the institution. But I think it'll be exciting. I don't know if I'm going to last 4 hours. I might wait for the clips until they come on, but it's exciting. But on the Michael Cohen testimony, I just, you know, I want to put it in perspective for you too. He is not going to testify to anything that's a pending Mueller investigation.
Of course, no, he's not.
So
and he
also it's just going to be.
He also could be such a sleazy witness.
I'm
worried.
He is such a sleazy witness.
Yeah. Going to be. It's going to be somewhat of a disappointment.
But he's our sleazy witness. I'm joking. But yeah, look.
He's
look,
not a Boy
no
Scout.
One, and who? And who? In any of,
of course,
these
in this
cases,
crowd,
extra
you're right.
Crowd,
who is
exactly.
the Boy Scout? That's a good. That's an excellent point. Robert Mueller is the Boy Scout.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
and the Marine.
I mentioned the introduction.
That's right.
The 5-4 decision, and by the way, it's the 5 conservative justices
yes.
that said the Trump ban may stay in effect pending the decision by the lower court. I think it is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Doesn't matter, whatever it is. The four more liberal members voted against it. Does one read into that? Now, that's only about whether or not the ban should be enjoined pending the decision.
Yeah.
But when there are 5 votes to say that we will not stay the action.
Yeah.
Pending the appeal, does that not suggest pretty strongly that Donald Trump's ban is likely to be upheld
does.
Ultimately?
It probably does, but I, you know, always be wary because you don't know if, you know, one or two of them think that there's enough legal questions and actually they don't have the factual basis, right? They don't, you know, for all we know, there are emails of which, you know, some general says the president is a homophobe or a transphobe and let's just do this for him, but it has no impact whatsoever. I mean, you know, this group of people has no impact whatsoever on our operational viability or in how the troops succeed. Because remember, the legal standards, is there a rational basis? I think a legal standard is, you know, is there a rational basis for the decision? And rampant, you know, LGBTQ phobia is probably not rational. On the other hand, you give the president a lot of leeway in terms of the makeup of our armed forces. I want to say 2 things on this. One is women are next. The only way Donald Trump wins, because he's looking at the numbers, is not just a race war, the race antagonism, not just the immigrant antagonism, is that men view women as too noisy, too transparent, and he is going to go after women in combat and women in the military next. The idea that this stops with LGBTQ is or with transgender is ridiculous. And the second is just to remind people of all the issues we have, not just in national security, but domestically, that this president would spend his time on a discreet group of people who
small
in a non-draft society. These are volunteers, a 5-time draft dodger, the president
that
himself.
I'm so glad you said that. That is what you can't argue that before the Supreme Court. The man who did this got 5 questionable deferments.
Yeah.
And he's basically saying that men and women who have the courage and will.
Yeah.
To serve their country, which I did not, he says.
Yeah.
I mean, he should be saying to himself, I want to make sure that they can't yeah. serve their country. It's just unbelievable.
Cruelty is the feature, not the bug, in so many of these
yeah.
policies. There's no, you know, you saw Seth Moulton's tweet and others who have served, you know, the idea that, you know, when someone's saving your life, that a medic might be transgendered is the last thing that you're thinking about, right? When you've been harmed, and just this is the cruelty is the feature. It is not the bug with this administration, and that they would spend this much time going after such a discrete group of people who don't have a lot of rights, in particular because it's the military, is just it's so shameful to be. But you know, amongst lots of shamefulness, but I do think that this is laying the foundation for them to begin to question the women in combat rules, because for them, you know, men, you know, the gender wars are the way that they are going to move forward.
Well, you saw yesterday's poll, though, his drop in support among suburban men, 18%.
Yeah.
That's a huge drop.
And I see
drop.
It in my, you know, 18%. I'm the CEO of a company, so, you know, a lot of my investors are very nice and put up with my, you know, obvious opinions about this president, but they voted for Trump the first time, and not that, you know, anecdote by coffee, but certainly it is, you know, of the Massachusetts sort of Republicans who, for whatever reason, could not stand Hillary Clinton and viewed Trump as being able to pivot. You know, they're looking for, you know, they're looking for someone to take on Trump on the Republican primary, or they're looking for a Democratic candidate who they will vote for this time. That this is just not sustainable. And I think they thought that all everything he said in the campaign was a joke. The wall is exhibit number one, right? I mean, Mexico's not paying.
Juliet, it's good to see you. Thanks
so
much. See you.
So short at 1 o'clock. I was 7:40 tonight. Unless something else happens.
Well, Jim's done by then at 7:30. So we can just go right to CNN at 7:40, and there you are.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see.
I'll be watching in my underwear on the couch.
Yeah, exactly. You get home that quickly.
See you later.
Bye. Thank you very much, Juliet. National security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us every week. She's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School and analyst for CNN and CEO of Zemcar. Thank you again, Juliet. Up next, for a nice break from all things political, naturalist and writer Cy Montgomery is here for this month's edition of the Afternoon Zoo, next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to lead our monthly edition of the Afternoon Zoo, a conversation at the intersection of animal and human behavior. Cy Montgomery. Cy's a journalist, naturalist, and a BPR contributor. A latest book, which didn't you tell me is like still
a bestseller
here?
In the Boston Globe. I see you every Sunday listed on there.
It's called How to Be
Montgomery.
A Good Creature,
yes.
A Memoir in 13 Animals. Hey there, Cy. Good to talk to you.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you all.
So, okay, you have just come back from this wonderful fellowship in Thailand. What were you doing?
Well, I was working with these Earthwatch scientists who are trying to study the most elusive and one of the most endangered wild dogs in the world, the dhole.
Never heard of it.
So I was going to call it the D-hole, so I'm so glad that you said it before I did. Thank goodness. Go ahead. It's D-H-O-L-E, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Tell us about the dhole.
The D-hole. Yeah, that kills me. People at international conferences actually thought that was how you pronounced it.
I'm so glad.
When we saw one of their dens, of course, that's when we said, look, it's the D-hole.
So why are we doing this?
They're so cool.
Why are we doing that, Cy Montgomery?
I got this like fabulous fellowship. Earthwatch and I go back a long way. And as you probably know, and many of your listeners may know, Earthwatch is based in Massachusetts, and it sends paying lay people who want to join real scientific expeditions on expeditions around the world. So during the time that you have for your like vacation, a couple of weeks, you can be part of a real expedition studying elephants or swimming with whale sharks or following kangaroos. It's fabulous. And people can just look up earthwatch.org and take a look at some of these expeditions that you can join. And because it's a charity, from the minute you leave your house, your vacation is a tax write-off. Or you can earn college credit for some of these things. I mean, it's just fabulous. So
is the dhole
actually?
And the reason the dhole is almost extinct. Is that not right?
They think that in the last like 20 years or so, their populations have been cut in half. But no one knows for sure because they are so elusive. These things they live in the forest. They live in sometimes very large packs, and while scientists are documenting how rare they are, a lot of local people think that there are tons of them because when you see dholes, there's often a lot. And they move around a lot. They've just started to get radio collars on these guys in Thailand recently. Where we were, which was the Khao Yai National Park, which is just a few hours' drive north and west from Bangkok, it's
the first national park that Thailand ever had, and it's the most touristed, people were thinking, even some of the park employees were thinking, gosh, there's a lot of these dogs. But apparently there's not. They were thinking, at one point, people were saying, oh, there's got to be 2,000 dholes in these forests. But it's probably fewer than 100. And that's because when people see them, they often see a lot of them.
Well, but if I recall correctly, I was reading your blog, actually, from Thailand. Finding them, despite what you said, was not an easy task for this mission, correct?
Oh, gosh. Yes, it was very difficult.
Why?
In fact, well, for one, they're smart. You know, they're dogs, and dogs are pretty smart. And what we were doing, we set up camera traps, you know, that snap their picture when they come to bait. Around the bait, we arrayed these padded traps, these padded leg hold traps that were intended to catch the animals as they came in to eat the bait. And we had it set up so that if any trap were triggered by anything, we would know it within 15 minutes. And each one of these trap arrays was set up so that we could get to it very, very quickly, like in 10 minutes. We were checking the telemetry to see if the trap had caught anything every 15 minutes around the clock. So we were very sleep deprived. And we would shoot out there and see, you know, did we catch anything? And we caught a lot of stuff, which is very interesting. Monitor lizards, oddly, love to eat the bait that we set out.
Oh.
Big lizards. And you go out expecting to see a dole, and there's this, you know, 5-foot lizard, carnivorous lizard. Another time we went out and we caught a large Indian civet, which looks like a giant cross between a weasel and a cat. Porcupines could set them off. They have these enormous porcupines there with quills that can be over a foot long.
But any dholes or no?
Set them off.
Did you end up?
We got camera trap pictures of dholes doing very cool stuff. But we never, the whole time I was there, we did not capture a live dole in the trap.
You know, Cy, when people know you, they know what the answer to this question is. But for people who are, no, but I'm serious, but for people who care as deeply as animals, about animals as you do, and they hear a trap, padded, as long as they're not in the trap for a long period of time,
okay,
protects the animal. Is that not what the whole point is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. If you put your hand in one of these traps, it doesn't hurt.
Okay.
But the thing about the dholes is that they will panic if they're caught. And their temperature source, it's a very strange thing about their physiology. So I've got to tell you, as much as I wanted to help with the study and as much as I would have loved to have seen a dole up close and personal, I was kind of relieved that we didn't have to tranquilize one of these guys, that we didn't have to stress one of these guys. And I was absolutely thrilled to see them on the camera traps. The last night, a dole did come to our trap array. Didn't get caught in the trap, but the camera trap showed the picture of a scout dole who was going this way around the tree and that way around the tree and smelling the bait, and he was very, very wary. And in the background, you could see two other doles just watching.
Wow.
Watching
great
to see if the scout dole was going to make sure that it was safe for them. And to me, what that revealed was the closeness of the pack and how much these other two doles in the pack, and who knows how many others, there could have been 20 other doles back there, but how much they trusted that scout dole and how important his job was or her job was and how beautifully that animal was doing his job. And so I got a feeling just from those camera trap pictures of just a little bit of what it might feel like to be in a dole pack.
We're talking to Cy Montgomery,
well,
like no other.
I don't know if you could also feel how it would be, what would it be like to be a frog who's just kind of rejected by the opposite sex. Tell us a poor
this
tale.
This one of the best stories ever.
Of Romeo the frog and the long tortured. I mean, lots of people can relate to this, Cy. The long tortured search for his true love.
Yes, that's right. And how he found true love, as so many people do, thanks to the internet.
Exactly. Match.frog.
Some matchdog frog. So tell us this story, Audible. I love this story, too.
Well, they named him Romeo. And he was actually 11, although the story said it was 10. And he was thought to be the last one of his kind on the planet. He was a Sinuiquis water frog, and they're native to this area in Bolivia, which is in the eastern Andes. And beautiful waterfalls and quick-running water at 6,000 to 9,000 feet.
Wow.
And Sinuiquis is the region in Bolivia where he was found, and the entire region was destroyed when a dam was built. So he was living at the Museo de Historia Natural al Cid d'Urbingi in Bolivia, right? And he was thought to be the last of his kind. But on Valentine's Day last year, these conservation groups created a Match.com profile, and the company raised $25,000 to fund an expedition to find Romeo, his Juliet.
And they did.
And they did.
Yeah, yeah. It was a big, long, difficult search, but they found, actually, I think two females and three males, and their plan is to breed them and maybe one day reintroduce them into the wild.
You know, one of the things that struck me about this story, Cy Montgomery, it says, this is the New York Times, he lives alone in a tank at this Museum of Natural History in Bolivia. I can't pronounce it, so I'm anglicizing it, obviously. How does an animal do that in living? I mean, obviously it lived alone because they thought it was the last one of its species. But if how does an animal like that do living alone year after year after year?
Well, I think that's why, you know, they called the last Pinta Island tortoise in the Galapagos Lonesome George.
Yeah.
Who died in 2012, the last of his kind. And recently, on your show, we talked about Sudan, the last male northern white rhino.
White rhino, you know? Right.
Yeah. You want to be the last man on Earth, Jim? I don't think so.
But I mean, what is the – I mean, I guess what I meant was, I don't mean physically. What is the psychological impact on this – I'm sure
he's
not seeing a shrink.
He's lonely and depressed.
I mean, what's the psychological impact on an animal
– these antidepressants.
That lives – that is the last one – or
Prozac.
That lives alone, even if it's not the last one of its breed – that lives in a museum, as this one did, by itself for all these years.
Yeah, I'm sure it's pretty awful. But on the other hand, thank God he was living in that museum, because now that he's found his Juliet,
right.
And inspired
right.
this whole search, maybe we can, you know, repopulate. And you know what I love, too, is the fact that this happened thanks to, you know, an internet campaign. And the last one of those that I can remember, and I think we discussed this too. Do you remember Jeremy the Lefty Snail?
I do, as a matter of fact, yes.
Yes. he was a garden snail who'd been found in a compost pile in southwest London, and he coiled left instead of right.
That's a riot.
And the thing is, your sex organs coil left instead of right if that's the case, and so it's very, very difficult to find someone to mate with. But thanks to the internet, thanks to – actually, it wasn't I don't think it was Match.com, but he had a Twitter account and Instagram. It was hashtag snail love, and they found six more snails. So
I love it.
So Cy Montgomery, I read a piece. Occasionally we talk about research where I'm not sure why the money was spent on something that, at least as a non-naturalist, is so obvious to me. There was a study, and was reported on in the Washington Post, about a lot of the things we think about cats, for example, cats like domesticated cats, not cats like mm-hmm. a dull, which is a dog, obviously, out in the wild, are antisocial. And then the headline says, maybe it's you. And they make the point, and correct me if I'm oversimplifying this, is you're part of the problem, you human. If you reach out literally or figuratively to your cat, our research shows that that cat is much more likely to respond in a social kind of way than he or she would otherwise. And my response is sort of, duh. Did we need this to know that animal-to-animal contact is likely to increase the likelihood of social behavior?
Well, I don't think you or I find that particularly surprising, but I think many people in the general public are shocked because they think that there's this anti-cat bias, I think, out there that cats are completely aloof and that they don't care about us. And the funny thing is, though, the thing that impressed me about the study was learning just how little cats have ever been studied, particularly compared to dogs.
Yeah, that is interesting, actually. And why is that, do you think, considering they're so much a part of people's lives in countries with money like this one?
Well, I think it's because, one, cats are more difficult to study. They're territorial, so they don't like to be in labs. In addition to this, the training techniques for cats are less obvious to we humans. You can train cats. You can train cats to do all kinds of things. I mean, you can even train tigers to do all kinds of things. But it's not as obvious to us how to do it. And the other issue is money, because dogs do all these things for us. They guide the blind. They assist hunters. They detect bombs, you know. And so a practical use for dog study is evident, and therefore there's money for it. But cats, that just isn't there. I mean, when you look at some of the dog studies that have been done, there's a bunch of canine cognition labs out there. And to study dog brains, for example, in a living, healthy dog, you teach the dog to go sit in a, ironically named, CAT scan, for example. Mm. The animal has to sit there for like 8 minutes. Now, trying to do that with a cat is much more difficult, but you can train a dog to do it. And once you do, they have found things like they process language in the same area of the brain as we do.
Oh, my God.
And when they are shown a picture of us or a smell of us, the same areas of their brain light up as when we think of them or when we think of our children. Yeah. But cats, we don't know these things because no one has figured out how to get a cat to sit still for 8 minutes.
You know, I think a related note before you go, people have seen a million of these. I happened to see a couple on Twitter last night, and they may not even be current. There was a scene where this daughter and it may be current, I don't know, a daughter and her father had, her father was some sort of naturalist and had raised these gorillas when they were little. They left, meaning the humans. They hadn't seen the gorillas in 10 years. And you've seen stories like this. And they come back. The video shows them coming down the river, the father calling out the name of the gorilla that they had given it. And then the end of the video, and I hope this is real, is a reuniting of the gorillas who clearly recognize the humans.
Did he crush them to death?
They hug them. I mean, they hug them.
Yes.
Almost, I mean... That, please tell me that's real and it's not.
Yes, it's real. This is Tansy Aspinall and the gorillas.
Oh, I think it is.
And gorillas will. I mean, they hug you just like they like we hug each other, and they easily recognize us.
Even if they haven't seen. In this case, they haven't seen these humans for the majority of their life. The majority of the gorilla's life. They had not seen the humans, and yet they remembered them as soon as they heard the voice and saw the faces. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this has been shown again and again with different animals. There was a chimpanzee who was on her death nest. She was dying. She lived in a research chimp colony where they observed their behavior. And one of the people who many years ago had worked with her showed up essentially to say goodbye. And she did exactly that. The dying chimp reached out and enveloped this elderly man in her arms. And, you know, though, I've had that same thing happen with an elderly octopus.
Have you? I was going to ask you that. Is that really true?
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I had seen her. They only live 3 to 5 years. And because she was sitting on eggs and because she was hiding in her lair, I hadn't seen her. For 10 months, she had not tasted my skin. She had not looked up to see me in 10 months. And when she was removed from that lair and put behind the scenes so that she wasn't in the public eye anymore and didn't have to face the glare of the lights and all that kind of, not that the lights were that glaring, but she was taken behind the scenes. I knew she was dying. She was sick and opened up that tank.
and she floated up to say goodbye to me.
Oh my God.
Why did she do that? Food. I was offering her food. She took it and just dropped it. And she enveloped me in her arms.
Oh, my God.
To taste me one last time.
Boy, do I love talking to you, Cy Montgomery.
Go buy The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery. Hey, Cy, it is great to talk to you, as always.
That was great.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to the two of you. You all are great.
Thank you, and congratulations for the success of your new book, How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir on 13 animals, bestseller in the Boston Globe. Cy Montgomery is a journalist, naturalist, and BPR contributor. Thanks again. Coming up, WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here for his take on the Oscar nominations next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest arts and culture events in and around town and to review the big snubs and surprises of this year's Oscar nominations is GBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's the host of the TV series. What's it called, Marjorie? I forget.
Open Studio.
That is correct. Open Studio, which you can get Friday nights at 8:30 right here on WGBH2. Hello, Jared Bowen.
Hello.
Hello, and I love your thing on Turner and Constable last week. I was absolutely drooling. So tell us this week about... as Jim just said, the snubs and surprises from the Oscars. Are there any?
Shall we talk about the snubs first?
Sure.
There are some big ones, actually, I thought.
Ethan Hawke. How about him?
And everybody was saying it's a lock that he'll win the Oscar, and then he didn't even get nominated. And that was for his film First Reformed, where he plays this priest.
Yeah.
Just really kind of at the end
what's
of
that about?
His days in which I have no idea. And this is a fascinating thing about the Academy. There's really no way of telling how they're thinking, although I would be inclined to think that they'd honor institutional people like Ethan Hawke, who hasn't been honored in that way before. And they just didn't do it. The other huge one I thought was Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary about Mr. Rogers, which had just audiences weeping as they look back at how he dealt with society and brought us all together and lifted us up, and apparently didn't lift us up enough because the Academy left him off the documentary list. I thought that was pretty exceptional.
You know, you and Michael Jeffries from Wellesley were nice enough to come join me last night. One of the focuses on Greater Boston was, you know, is Oscars, hashtag Oscars so white, just in the rear view mirror kind of thing. You know, on the plus front, Black Panther is the first superhero film ever nominated for Best Picture. Spike Lee, finally, I think one of the greatest directors of our lifetime, finally for Black Klansman, gets a nomination. The diversity of the Academy itself is increasing. So what's the takeaway on that front? How much progress are they actually making?
Well, I think it's mixed. You can't have just wholesale change overnight. And by overnight, I'm acknowledging that it's been several years now that the Academy has been trying to change its makeup, but it's still predominantly male and it's still predominantly white. And in the nominations, at least in front of the camera yesterday, you saw a lot of white faces, just two black actors nominated for roles. However, what I think is a really positive sign is the stories that are being told right now. So if you look at the nominees for Best Picture, and of course, we have an expanded list now because that's the new format, but you have A Star is Born. Of course, that's a classic story. But then you have Black Klansman, about an African-American police officer or detective infiltrating the KKK. Of course, that's the Spike Lee-directed film. You have Black Panther, which, by the way, is the first superhero movie to be nominated for Best Picture. You have Bohemian Rhapsody, Freddie Mercury, an Indian man, you know, this man of Indian parents who has to deal with this, and this is dealt with in the film. Some of the racial slurs that he dealt with coming up and how he shielded that off by developing this persona to become who he was. You have The Favorite, about a lesbian tryst in this trifecta here, and The Green Book, of course, which has been controversial, about the partnership of this black singer being taken to the South, needing a green book to know where to stay, and then Roma and
in Mexico,
and then Vice, back to Dick Cheney. So this, I think it's very representative of not only the country right now, but also the world in terms of some of the stories that are being brought forward.
It also makes you second-guess the critics, because I read a lot of reviews that were not hot on Bohemian Rhapsody or Vice, and yet they're nominated for Best Picture. So what do I make of that?
Yeah, you don't have to make a lot of the critics, which I always say, and you listen to me, we're all one person, and I don't necessarily always consider myself a critic. I often try to give as much information as possible, but we're one person with one sensibility and background that comes to the fore. I had read the same thing, and I had missed Bohemian Rhapsody when it first came out and was able to circle back to it a few weeks ago, and I was struck by how great the storytelling was in really getting a sense of who Freddie Mercury was. And not only did it succeed in giving us a sense of his personality, but it gave us the voice. I mean, it's a pretty hard thing to do on film, to just demonstrate how resonant, how singular that voice was.
Can I interrupt for one second? This is a pretty major news story. This is a statement by Lanny Davis, the attorney for Michael Cohen. It's tweeted out by Maggie Haberman from the New York Times. Mr. Cohen volunteered to testify before the House Oversight Committee on February 7th due to ongoing threats against his family from President Trump and Mr. Giuliani as recently as this weekend, as well as Mr. Cohen's continued cooperation with ongoing investigations by advice of counsel. Cohen's appearance will be postponed to a later date. I have no idea what the threats are, but that's a pretty major development. No hearing before the House Oversight Committee on February 7th.
Well, you've heard the constant mention of his father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
That's been one of the recurring themes. Giuliani says they keep going after the father-in-law. Now, I don't know if that's about the father-in-law, or I hope it's not about his children or his wife, but that's the only thing I've heard mentioned.
So one more thing on the Oscar. Boy, it's so weird to go from that to this to that. Nobody's going to host this. It's going to be one of these collaborative kind of deal kind of things.
You know what? This is, if I were producing the Oscars, this is what I would do. And this is what you remember anyway. You just get somebody to come in and produce a big musical, you know, showbiz style opening number. Get somebody like Hugh Jackman or Neil Patrick Harris to open the show.
Why doesn't Doogie Howser do all these things? Or Neil
exactly.
He's so great at this.
Just give a lot of razzle dazzle at the beginning. Make it fun. Get us off to a really high spirited start, and then do what they always do, which is just have the presenters come out. You never really pay attention to the hosts after, except to talk about how bad they were, because they have all these bits that don't work, like the Golden Globes and that ridiculous thing with the flu shots.
God.
So you never pay attention to the hosts anyway after the opening.
So let's go to the stage from the Oscars. Othello, obviously, at the ART, which I am dying to see. Have you seen it?
You should be dying to see it.
Really?
I just saw it last night, and it is really, really exceptionally fine theater.
Why?
Everything just comes together well here. So this
is contemporary, right?
They give it a modern day setting, which really, really works. In fact, I would say that of all of the Shakespeare productions I've seen, this is the best example of taking Shakespeare and putting it in a modern setting.
Oh, great!
So here we find that Othello is an admiral in the U.S. Navy. And just to give people a quick background on the story, if you need a refresher course, you know, he is this really successful leader, but he is black, he is a converted Christian, and he is now, very quickly he becomes stationed in Cyprus, so he is also a foreigner. So in many ways, he is the other, and this is why he's constantly referred to in the play, not by his name Othello, but the Moor, and other racial slurs taking him down. But we find him at the beginning of the play, as I said, this very successful leader. He has the troops that support him and has lots of success, has just married Desdemona, the daughter of a senator. But Iago, his subordinate, from the very moment we meet him, is duplicitous and just wants to take Othello down. He does that by tainting and poisoning his relationship with Desdemona, and of course it becomes very dark. I just thought this was so exquisitely directed by Bill Rausch, who we saw did Fingersmith and All the Way with Bryan Cranston,
which was brilliant,
at the ART, which of course went on to Broadway. But it's such... As we often say, Shakespeare remains resonant no matter what time you're looking at in history. And certainly, as looking at Othello here as the other is so important. But I also really loved the portrayal of Iago, which I thought was very, very sly, because he's this good-looking guy and kind of has – he looks like an ex-frat boy. And he represents the sense of this white person who has felt that they're entitled, that we keep reading about now, who can't understand how the world around them has suddenly changed and that he, as a white man, doesn't have all of the power. So that really comes to the fore here. And he, when he addresses the audience, I think this is a great bit of directing. the house lights come up. So as he's telling us about his plan to take down Othello, the house lights come up and you in the audience, you see yourself, you see everybody around you, and you feel complicit because you are the society around. It's bone chilling.
Great. And by the way, for those who are wondering, who are sitting out, I did not play an Othello in Friends Select, if you were listening last week.
And you know what's so great about the ART? You get so close. You feel like you're so close to the stage. It's a wonderful thing. What about this, the Wolves, the soccer team story? This sounds fascinating. Should we send all our little soccer players to see this?
Well, you had one, didn't you? A star soccer player.
She was pretty good.
We should send everybody to see this. We have a really good week to talk about theater in this town. This is presented by Lyric Stage Company. By the way, I mentioned Othello, and it's playing through February 9th at the ART. The Wolves is presented by Lyric Stage Company through February 3rd, and this is a piece that was a finalist for the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. And we meet a group of young girls at practice. They're just doing drills and they're doing what girls do. If you can remember back into when you were that age and you're around all of your friends, they move from rapid clip and conversation, taking on everything from their families and their parents to watching Netflix documentaries. Why would you watch a Netflix documentary? To discussing the Khmer Rouge. But they move with the rapidity that they might move through their drill actions. And so we enter into their world. And what I was really struck by is, first of all, there's terrific directing here, too, because it just keeps on the move. These actors are literally moving for most of the play between the drill exercises, running around the theater space, so you feel like you're in their space. But also just the fierceness and the toughness that these girls have, because without giving anything away, they are beset with a tragedy at one point. And just watching how they process that and how they deal with that, and you think back to when you're a child and you are confronted by some sort of loss or some sort of trauma, and you have to move on, essentially. You know, people aren't always capable of moving on, but there is a remarkable resiliency that I think that kids have, and that really comes to the fore here.
So are you exuberant about the end of TV, too? This is like a big week for you in the theater.
I'm also equally exuberant. Really? I will also say The Wolves is very, very funny. In addition to dealing with tough subject matter, it's also really funny. So the end of TV is like theater that most of us have not seen.
Where's this?
This is at Arts Emerson, being done just through January 27th, so I guess through this weekend. And it's presented by Manual Cinema, which is a Chicago-based theater company. And the story here is of two women. You have Flo, an older white woman who was once a factory working in an auto plant. She was a supervisor in an auto plant, and now she's older. She's at home. She's slipping into dementia, so she's watching a lot of television. And we see how that television, especially in the 1990s, watching QVC and things of that nature, they start to intercede in her life. And then Louise is a young black woman who has just lost her job at the auto plant factory. This takes place in some Midwest Rust Belt city or town. And so she comes to meet Flo by way of Meals on Wheels and decides to take care of her. So that's the story. But the way the story is told is through actors using silhouettes and projections and music on stage. So the whole story is told almost through animation on a screen that you can watch, or you can, your eyes dart down and you see the actors doing all of these elements on stage. And again, using those overhead projectors that you might remember from middle school high school, the teacher would slip the covers on and then one kid would have to erase all of the, do you remember those?
Of course.
I mean, they are so clever and it is so meticulous because all of this is told in that way. It's really ingenious. Genius theater telling.
Okay, we got one more. Do we have one more?
Well, also, I'm so glad we got to this because one, it's in one of our favorite cities, Providence. And two, I've actually heard great things about this theater, even though I haven't been there. What's the deal with the Night Watch?
This is the GAM Theater, which just moved from their home in Pawtucket to Warwick, Rhode Island. And they have a new space, and I braved the storm to go down over the weekend, and I'm so glad that I did. The Night Watch is actually a U.S. premiere, and it's based on a novel by Sarah Waters, who wrote Fingersmith, which we just mentioned. Bill Rouse had directed that at the ART, and adapted by Hattie Naylor. And this is a piece that moves backward in time. It starts in London in 1947, so just after the war. And we have these people kind of spinning about, and you understand why they're spinning about as this piece moves backward to 1944 and then to 1941. And we understand what their lives were like living in the war when you have bombs raining down around you. It was interesting. As I was reading this, I was thinking, of course, we now know how the war turned out. The Allies won and they rebuilt. built. Of course, they didn't know that at the time. So here you have this moment where their life is literally exploding around them and they don't know what to make of life and losing their purpose in life. And we see how they wind their way through that through this piece.
So, you know, Warwick, what is it, 10 miles from Providence or something? We don't talk with you much about, and we're in the show airs in
yes,
Providence
yep.
too. We don't talk about much about the theater and the cultural scene in Providence. I think it's great. I love that you include this thing. I mean, Greater Providence, obviously. What is the world like? I mean, it's a small, great city. We all know it for its restaurants and its river and its so many great things there. We've had the governor on a couple of times, Raimondo. What's the culture scene like?
And for as small as Rhode Island is, it has great contributions to theater. You have a really small group called the Burbage, which I've been hearing more and more about. I haven't been there, but they're a conversation starter. You have the GAM, which is very ambitious in its plans. It's a small theater group, but it takes on big topics. I mean, this is a U.S. premiere. The artistic director, Tony Estrella, read about this play in London and got on the phone and
That's
said,
great.
We want to bring it here.
I am right. It's right outside. Providence.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's about 5 miles,
miles
I'd
or
say.
Okay,
it's not that far from Providence.
Close. Okay,
it's right at the airport.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same exit as TF Green. And then you have Trinity Rep. And mm-hmm. then you also have Design.
Trinity Rep is great.
And design museums like RISD, where it seems like every time you're reading about some major artist working today, they had some affiliation at some point through RISD. So it is really, really vibrant. Shura Baryshnikov, who I've talked with, I think you may have had her on the radio too, a movement director and really big force in theater, daughter of Baryshnikov.
Oh, no,
really?
Is that so?
Oh, my goodness.
You haven't at least
I think
wasn't
you'd like
that.
She's based at Brown, so it's a very vibrant community there.
Who was the mother? the famed actress?
Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange.
No, is that so?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
What's she look like?
You know, you are the most superficial person.
I am superficial.
Ask him off the
well,
air.
Think
we
about
all want
he
to
has
know.
The parental but... gene, you know, sweepstakes. Baryshnikov and Jessica Lange.
She's very, I will tell you, she's very, very talented because she's been doing a lot more up here in Boston in terms of movement that she creates with different productions, and it's terrific.
So before you go, we talked about this McJesus sculpture in Israel last week. There's an update, correct? Can you give us in a minute what the controversy was and then what the conclusion, if you want to call it that, is?
So the controversy was there was this Finnish artist who did this McJesus sculpture, which is putting Ronald McDonald on the cross as a way to talk about the fact that we worship as a society capitalism and culture. We're culture obsessed. There was a call by the Arab Christian community to have this piece removed from this museum in Israel. The museum said absolutely not. It had been up for about 5 months anyway before people started to take notice by social media. However, after we spoke last week, there started to be big protests. Three officers were injured when they were throwing stones. The attacks became even more elevated. So at this point, the piece is being pulled from the museum.
So what are you doing on Open Studio?
Oh,
we're out of
time. Oh, yeah, in 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry,
we're
I forgot
out of time.
About
Well, I can save you because unfortunately we're not on the air this week, but we will be back next week.
Oh,
okay.
Fair enough.
Well, that takes care of that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we are done. Thank you very much
good
for
to see you, Jared.
Listening to,
good to see you.
Boston Public Radio. And tomorrow we want to let you know that we have Congresswoman Catherine Clark is going to be with us, Andrea Cabral and Paul Rebel on education stuff, including that terrible story in the Boston Globe about the valedictorians from the non-exam high schools that have a very difficult
read it.
Time.
The Sunday Globe
it's,
magazine.
It's a great piece of reporting, a very sad piece of reporting. Jared, of course, is WGBH arts editor and host of the TV series Open Studio. Friday nights at 8:30 is off this week, though. Okay, Jim, what do you got on TV?
Well, Shirley Leung from the Globe and Charlie Chippio, regular on the radio with us, is going to join me to talk about, you know, Charlie Baker ran as this no-new taxes candidate. We talked with him about it last week. But after pushing a series of, I think euphemistically, we call them revenue raisers, is it really fair to call him the no-new taxes governor? And if he's breaking his pledge, should he be celebrated for the things he's doing it for? Also, we're going to continue the handheld cell phone conversation, the ban that Baker filed. Hunter Levitan, whose sister Merritt was the young woman I told you was killed by a distracted driver in Arkansas. And Mayor McGuire, who is the head of, she's the PR and legislative director for AAA in New England, are going to talk about the pros and cons of this I would argue, I don't know if there are cons, really, really important proposal to save lives on Beacon Hill.
He's Jim Browdy.
I'm
Marjorie.
Always
Egan.
Confuses me.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm Jim Browdy, and
Marjorie
you're Marjorie.
Thank you very much for listening.
See you tomorrow.
Please tune in again tomorrow, and have a great afternoon.